So I just got off the phone after waiting for about, well, over an hour on hold with the insurance company, and gosh, this is, you know what? This is why we need some sort of universal single-payer coverage, and profit needs to be taken out of the entire insurance scheme.
It's showtime.
Go head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. A little bit belated, but here we go, off and running on this, the 7th day of October 2021. This is The Horn. HeadOn.live is where you'll find us on the interweb, too, so that's where you go if you'd like to be part of the merry, wacky, zany, real-time multimedia extravaganza that is The Horn chat room during the 3 hours in which this program is live, Monday through Friday, 5 to 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, and all times in between and the great globe around, you know, when it's live or whenever it is you're listening. It's just that nobody will be there except those hours for the most part. But right now, if you wander by the chat room, you'll be immediately greeted by early arrivers. Well, not so early now. I'm the late arriver. Anatole and Jeremy in Vermont and Ralphs and Squeaky and Stockton Larry and capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a third stage guild navigator, has folded space to become Man Cave. He is capably assisted by pinch hit midweek chat room utility moderator and all around great guy, Brother Bishop Steve from Georgistan. And so, well, we're off and running for this thorn in the side Thursday, and it is kind of a, it's kind of a perfect thorn, really, just trying to get a simple question answered through a for-profit insurance company that has farmed out its so-called customer service. I don't think it's an accident. To some far-flung, well, the globe doesn't have corners now, does it? It's a sphere, for God's sakes. It's slightly oblate, I think. Is that the word I'm looking for? Oblate? I don't know. Who cares? But somewhere far, 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 far away, and God knows the voice transmission makes it abundantly clear that it is. And so after over an hour on various forms of hold, I finally got someone who was terribly, 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 terribly unable to help me. So I get to do that all again tomorrow and kiss another hour or more of my precious finite time upon this sweet little blue-green marble hurtling in its helical way around the sun around the galaxy, the galaxy around the cosmos, etc., etc., etc. Fuck. Anyway, every program here at The Horn begins with gratitude, and this program is no different. So thanks go out to our seventh day of the month subscribers. What does that mean? That means we send out thanks to James, and thank you very kindly indeed. And also we send thanks to our buddy Hung Like Jesus. Thank you oh so kindly for jumping in on the fundraising goal that reduces our fundraising hole for this evening to $820. Thank you very kindly, and hopefully we'll knock some more of that down, because I had a note from our dear friend Rico the continuing fuck Joe Manchin and add in that bratty asshole Kristen Cinnabon, Kirsten Cinnabon, or as Joy in Ann Arbor refers to her, Kirsten Enema. So a $50 challenge, and we'll kick in another $50 when it's met. I'm so over this bullshit, Robin. I just can't anymore. Anyway, it's not really hot here in the Berg, but it's so sticky humid for some ungodly reason. Maybe that's why I'm so grouchy. Your buddy and pal forever, our buddy here in this community. Thank you, Rico, in the sticky, humid, but not particularly hot Berg. So if $50 rolls in, Rico will double it and add 50 to it, and that'll get us down to, $680 to go, and that'll mean we will be done. We will be done with fundraising. Monday was covered, and we'll have $80 to go on Tuesday, and then we'll deal with Wednesday and today, and hopefully not have a great big humongous hole to fill for Friday on the front porch tomorrow. Thank you, Rico. Thank you so very kindly, and hopefully people will step up on that. Had a note. By the way, Steve in New York says simply, everyone, that includes everyone. I hate everyone. Thanks, Joe Manchin. Okay, says Steve, I'm done. I only hate him. Oh, I know. I think it's okay to hate Kirsten Enema, too, because she is so thoroughly, completely, utterly, and absolutely awful. And the issue that will not go away, I had a note from Ron in Raleigh, who is still kind of not happy about the way things turned out a couple of nights ago. Last thing I'll say about this, regarding the conversation between Steve, Todd, you and me concerning Senator Sinema's chosen attire, the aftermath of the conversation has been grinding on me so to clear the air, I felt I should write this. I debated with myself whether I should write this. However, I came to the conclusion that if I didn't, it would continue to cause me upset. Okay, well, and burrs under saddles are always awful. Bees under bonnets and the like. First of all, the fact that you went immediately to the statement that commenting on a woman's attire is the same as the sexist, that say women are sexists who say women are asking for rape or sexual abuse. I'm offended by being thrown into that bucket. I've always seen that as a stupid thing to say, and I call out anyone that says it. That statement is putting me in the same category as Jesse Lee Peterson. He did. When he said, rape is about sex, not power. I will not be put into that group of troglodytes. A day later, Tracy called in to chastise me and the others concerning our opinions, to which I take even more offense. I'm too old to be chastised for my opinions by any male, anyone male, cis, female, or trans. There are many times I've disagreed with things Tracy said on air. However, I've never written to chastise her. I believe she is entitled to her opinions. I have heard females on air like Stephanie Miller commenting on Senator Sinema's choices. I will not kowtow to anyone regarding my opinions. As far as Senator Sinema's attire, I believe she dresses the way she does to call attention to herself, so that is it is a distraction from her not doing the job her constituents sent her to Washington to do. When she flounced down to the well of the Senate to dip and give a thumbs down to an increase in the minimum wage, it was actually a middle finger to the underpaid in Arizona and the rest of the country. And I called that out. There was more talk about her dip and thumbs down than the substance of her vote. No one mentioned that before she voted, she presented a cake to the person presiding and gave Mitch McConnell a pat on the back. She's a narcissistic self-promoter, and her flamboyant style is just another thumb in the eye of other Democrats. She's cut from the same cloth as Joe Manchin. The look at me, I can fuck over everyone's school. You may and probably do disagree with my assessment. That's your right, but I will not be called out. It's like some naughty schoolboy because of my opinion. That's my final say on the subject. Very well. Ron, you've had your final say. And it's interesting, the split in the community that entire discussion created. I'll stand with mine. You stand with yours. I do not in any wise defend her, because her actions are awful, continue to be awful, and frankly, I don't think she's particular. You know, the position she takes, simply parroting those equally ignorant positions espoused by Joe Manchin, it doesn't play well, and she comes across not particularly favorably for having taken them. But she doesn't care about whether she is intellectually sound. She is doing the bidding of her superiors, the people who give her lots of money. So there's that. But, you know, maybe this thing will go away. But I did find it interesting that, you know, we talked about, what was her name? Sage Steele, who on a podcast, we discussed it on yesterday's program, said women are asking for it when they interview male professional athletes and wear anything short of a burlap sack. I don't know. They know what they're doing, she said. Thank you, Steve, in New York, for getting us started on fundraising this evening, taking a $10 bite out of Rico's challenge, the continuing Fuck Joe Manchin and add Kirsten Cinnabon into the mix challenge. Thank you, Steve. Thank you very, very kindly. 40 more, and it's met, and then we will try to get Tuesday. That's a starting place goal, trying to get Tuesday fully funded. Okay? Where else to go with the start of the program? I had some things that I didn't get to yesterday evening, simply because I had to quit the program early for a meeting. So we'll pick up kind of where we left off yesterday evening. And where that is, since we talked about the weeping and the wailing and the gnashing of teeth by the woman from, what was it, Bloomfield, Talibandiana, who loves her country so much, and she's getting shunned at her beauty parlor? Yeah, I know. Well, enter Robert Tesh. Robert Tesh is a 34-year-old man from Detroit, Michigan. And this past Tuesday, he was, after previously entering a guilty plea, actually, this is an interesting form of plea with which I am not particularly familiar that they have on the books up in Michigan. Apparently, when charged with a crime in Michigan, there is the availability of a plea of guilty but mentally ill. And so last August, Robert Tesh, age 34, pleaded guilty but mentally ill in the Wayne County Circuit Court in Michigan. And the guilty plea was for having made credible death threats against Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel and Governor Gretchen Whitmer, both of them women, both of them high-ranking officials of the state of Michigan. He committed the crime, and we can say he committed it because he pled guilty. He committed the crime, made the threat on the 14th day of April, 2020. He was talking to somebody he knew on a social media messenger app. The same day he made the threats, he was arrested and charged with false report or threat of terrorism. And so that began the process. What he did, was to basically threaten to kill the Attorney General of Michigan and the governor thereof. This is alongside, you might recall, the case of the five men who were part of a Donald Trump supporter plot to kidnap and hold a kangaroo court trial for Gretchen Whitmer because she had placed restrictions on public behavior as a result of COVID-19 as it burned through the state of Michigan. Oh, you remember? Remember? Because I remember. I want to mow my snow. I can't go out water skiing on the frozen waters of Lake Michigan because of that damn Gretchen Whitmer. And so they were going to kidnap her try her, so they'd already found her guilty, and then execute her. Well, that hasn't happened yet. There's a trial date of March the 8th, 2022, for those five guys. So this Robert Tesh was separate from that, but the fact that these death threats were made and the people they were made against remains a compelling picture of the behavior of the maggots. This happened long before, January 6th or anything, but it was a harbinger of things to come. So, yes, Robert Tesh, age 34, pled guilty but mentally ill. And today, or Tuesday rather, was his sentencing. Now, Attorney General Dana Nessel, addressing the court not as the Attorney General of the state of Michigan, but rather, quote, as a concerned citizen and a loving wife and mother, informed the court that the threats made by Tesh and others like them have, quote, deeply impacted her family and caused them to live in a state of almost constant fear, and that's more than understandable. In her note to the court, she said, this is not how it should be. The deluge of threats that public officials have faced in the last year is unprecedented and unacceptable. No public official should be frightened of doing their job. I've always supported the public's right to disagree and voice that disagreement. It's our First Amendment right as Americans. But when that disagreement crosses the line into a politically motivated threat of violence, it must be prosecuted. There's it must be prosecuted. And then there's, it must be prosecuted seriously. And so when I saw this story, it seemed to sort of dovetail with the other stories coming out of January the 6th, to the extent that there seems to be a lot of wrist slapping going on. Because, well, for credibly threatening to murder the Attorney General and Governor of the state of Michigan, Robert Tesh, well, the long arm of the law reached out and grabbed Robert Tesh and said, now stop that. No, really. Robert Tesh, for having credibly threatened the life of the Attorney General and Governor of the state of Michigan, well, he was facing up to 20 years in prison. But, you know, I-O-K-I-Y-A-R, right? Because the maggots, tender, delicate fifis, are so tender and delicate, and so it's understandable when something happens that they don't like, and they lash out like the poo-flinging monkeys that they are. Poo-flinging or bullet-flinging, lead-flinging monkeys that they are. And threaten the lives of people with whom they disagree. And so Robert Tesh, age 34, is going to spend five long years of his life not being in prison. Really? He's going to spend five long, hard years living at home, going to and fro, doing as he pleases. He's got 5 years of probation. Really? That's the punishment for threatening to slaughter the Attorney General and Governor of the state of Michigan, at least according to a circuit judge in Wayne County, Michigan. Yeah. Five tough, hard, back-breaking years of probation. Yeah, it's not going to be easy for Robert Tesh. He's going to have to go to counseling. No, really. He's going to have to have mental health treatment. And every 3 months, a mental health professional will have to file a psychiatric report on Robert Tesh. Every 3 months, for those long, hard, grueling years, every 3 months, He doesn't get to own or possess any firearms or weapons that anybody knows about. Mm-hmm. And he's also going to have to pony up a whole $1,898 in fees. Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Because my ciphering is always suspect, let's use the calculator for that. So 5 times 12 is 60. 60 months. 1,898 divided by 60 equals... Whew. Now listen, people. Don't be running around threatening statewide elected officials in Michigan because a circuit judge in Michigan might make you pay $31.63 for doing it in fees and court costs. And you don't want to be doing that kind of hard time. If you can't do the time or not, don't do the crime. I tell you what, that sure did show those maggots up in Michigan, didn't it? They won't be running around there making credible threats against the Attorney General or the Governor. Unless they want to. That's it. That's all. That's all. Yep. Stephen New York offers a revision to IOKIYAR. It's now, according to Steve, IOKIYAWR, and that means it's okay if you're a white Republican. Well, I thought that just kind of went as read in the Republican part, Steve. In this instance, as Mark Twain once noted, the subject may be considered to be over-described. But yeah, I get your point. Whew. Don't screw up, Robert Tesh, or they might extend your probation. Must have had a darn fine public defender there. Because that's a pretty snazzy deal. But that's just, you know, that's just one case. Meanwhile, let's run down to Maryland on this Thorn in the Side Thursday. And this is a real youch! This case concerns a man and his brother. I don't want to get all Casey Kasem on this, but... It's the out of the Baltimore Sun. It's the story of 46-year-old Jeffrey Burnham and his 58-year-old brother, Brian Robinette. Yes, you've heard that name before. The middle name of the President of the United States is Robinette. It is apparently a fairly common name in that general vicinity. Hmm? Well, according to the article in the Baltimore Sun, Jeffrey Burnham, 46 years old, got really, really upset with his 12 years older big brother because his big brother was a pharmacist. Yeah, Jeffrey Burnham is from Cumberland, Maryland. Brian Robinette and his spouse lived in Ellicott City, Maryland. And Jeffrey Burnham barged into their Ellicott City home last week and slaughtered his big brother and his sister-in-law. Mm-hmm. He apparently told his mama, "I got mama. I got to deal with Brian. Brian's poisoning people. He's a pharmacist, mama. He's poisoning people." Because he was giving people the COVID-19 vaccine. He said, "Brian knows something." And so he stabbed 83-year-old Rebecca Reynolds to death inside her home in Cumberland, Maryland, on September the 29th. Then, having killed her, he stole her car. He went to Ellicott City, Maryland. And the next day, he murdered his brother, Brian Robinette, and his wife, Kelly Sue Robinette. And he's now facing first and second degree murder charges. Naturally, Jeffrey Burnham, aged 46, of Cumberland, Maryland, took it on the lam. To where? Of course, we know, right? Sure we do. He got caught in West Virginia. He went to Davis, West Virginia. Yeah. There was an 18-hour manhunt for him. Good God. And, well, he had not made any bones, Jeffrey Burnham hadn't, about telling people why he was doing what he was doing. He said, "He's killing people with the COVID shot." Now, where on earth would he have gotten an idea like that? Now, Evelyn Burnham had called the Cumberland police twice in the previous week because she said her son's mental stability was not good. Among other things, he said, "Mama, the FBI is after us both." She said, my son lives with me, and he keeps a security system in his bedroom." And then Evelyn Burnham called him again on September 30th. And it turns out, Becky, he was obsessed with Becky's car, and Becky was Evelyn Burnham's friend, a friend of hers that she'd had since childhood. It was a Lincoln. And that's the car he drove to Ellicott City to kill his brother and sister-in-law. He slit her throat. Put a pillow over her face and slit her throat. Yeah. Because of the way we view notions of causation, there will be no charges against any of the assholes out there who have pumped toxin into the body politic about, the COVID-19 vaccine making it possible for Bill Gates to track you with his 5G cell phone towers it doesn't matter who spread it, whether it was Robert F. Kennedy Jr., or some crazy-ass doctor from the Houston suburbs who thinks that demons steal men's penises and hide them at the bottom of the ocean. Nope. But by the same token, you can't understand why someone would do something like this without understanding the amount of poison that's floating around. That's floating around in this country right now. We will, for instance, have our usual evening salute to the Herman Cain Award, because there's no dearth of them. And apparently, Jeffrey Burnham had a thing about nice cars. He took the Lincoln first, Becky's Lincoln, and then after he had killed his own brother and his sister-in-law, he grabbed their 2007 red Corvette and headed for the hills and hollers of almost level West by Coal Trump Ginyistan, proving that there is really no need for a tracking device in the vaccine. Police searching for Jeffrey Burnham eventually found his brother's cell phone off the exit ramp of Route 100 on the way to I-95 North. And then they tracked him some more because he used the red Corvette to go through the Baltimore Harbor Tunnel at about 8:30 a.m. on September the 30th. And then there was a tipster who called the Maryland State Police and said he came back to Cumberland a little before 5 p.m. on the 30th, driving the Corvette, and asked somebody for gas and said, "Y'all see me on TV." Mm-hmm. Telling the same person, "My brother was killing people with the COVID-19 vaccine." Yeah. So they found him, eventually, 6 days ago, Jeffrey Burnham, in, like I said, Davis, West Virginia, at the Billy Motel and Bar. He flagged down a fire. God almighty. The hard-working Maryland police officers would never have gotten the big break they needed if the dude himself had not flagged down a firefighter and said, "I was forced to kill three people." And so he's held without bond in Allegheny County, Maryland. And at least as of the report from the Baltimore Sun, he did not have counsel of record. Yeah. Alex Jones will not be charged as an accessory before the fact for having aided and abetted the murder of these three innocent individuals. Neither will Tucker Carlson or Frau Ingram, nor will any of the Looney Tunes that we regularly feature on things like Prayer Meeting Wednesday and Moran Monday and Titanic Tuesday and any other day, who are out there hooting and barking and grunting about how, and you know they're not going to go after Sage Steele for saying that the shot is scary and wrong, but I'll bet you this. I'll bet you that if the hardworking members of Maryland law enforcement actually look at his browsing history, they're going to find all kinds of different people in it who are spreading this kind of homicide-inducing poison. Why? Because they're stochastic terrorists. And the way stochastic terrorism works, well, let's put it this way. A bullet is personal. You aim a gun at someone and squeeze the trigger. I'm sorry, I don't want to upset the little gun humpers. And squeeze the trigger, and the bullet explodes out of the muzzle of the gun and generally goes toward the person that you're aiming at. On the other hand, stochastic terrorism is more like a fragmentation grenade. You pull the pin and you chuck it, and it goes kaboom and just spreads death all around it. You don't particularly know who it is you're going to kill when you chuck a grenade, like you do when you aim a gun and squeeze the trigger. And that's stochastic terrorism. The people who have spread this malicious filth don't necessarily know who's going to kill or who's going to be killed. They just know that they're spreading information so that someone will kill and someone will be killed. And they did their... And they don't care if they're preying upon weak-minded people or people suffering from behavioral health disorders. They just want people to die. No word yet on whether or not Jeffrey Burnham will be given 5 years probation with a necessity of psychiatric reports every 3 months. No, no, no. Merca. Good point, Brother Deacon Asa. Why does Pooty Poot need to start an expensive hot shooting war when he can get literal brothers in Merca to slaughter each other from ear to ear? Well, one brother did all the slaughtering, it appears, in this case. Oddly enough, the information in this thing was under seal for some reason or another, but the case file was unsealed, and that's why we know about a week later about the actions of Jeffrey Burnham. No word yet on whether or not he was getting his instructions from the fillings in his teeth or radio transmissions from a satellite into a flashlight from the Fairfax, Virginia Volunteer, Fairfax County, Virginia Volunteer Fire Department. I've told that story before. Don't need to go into that. Or whether it was just Tucker Carlson or somebody at Onan, the network that spills its news upon the ground, or Newsmuck or Frau Ingram or the Hannity job or Alex Jones. Yeah. Or maybe a preacher, you know, carrying the full authority and color of theology of Jesus H. Christ. You know, maybe a Greg Locke or one of the myriad other assholes out there. No word on that. It would be an interesting thing to delve into if one were, say, a professional journalist. But no. Nothing so far on that. Maybe the case will pop back up in a year or two, and we'll say, hey, remember that time when? And, yeah. Right. Oh, God. Ron in Raleigh says, hell, that old boy was charged with something. 5 years probation, that's horribly harsh punishment compared to this yokel. Remember, there's no racism. And the story comes to us from the Daily Beast. He ran over Black Lives Matter protesters, but apparently that's not a crime. He joked on social media about running down protesters and fled the state after he actually did it to get out of a situation he felt was dangerous to his family, so he said. Jared Benjamin Lafer, or perhaps Laffer, last September, drove his SUV through a tiny assemblage of Black Lives Matter protesters in Johnson City, Tennessee, and then sped away. One man got a concussion, a brain bleed, had two broken legs, and Jared Benjamin Lafer is going to do exactly zero time. He's not even going to be troubled with a trial because a grand jury in Tennessee, and remember, grand juries are always led by prosecuting attorneys, or at least informed by prosecuting attorneys. This past Monday, returned a no true bill. That means the possibility of indictment has been presented to the grand jury, and the grand jury in Johnson City, Tennessee, said, nah, no big deal. Self-defense, something like that. Because even before the grand jury got the case, a judge lowered the charges from aggravated assault, a Class C felony, to reckless aggravated assault, a Class D felony. And they even had cell phone video of him rolling over the protester with his truck, almost striking a second person who jumped out of the way, even though he wasn't even trying to swerve, and then he sped away. Yeah. It was a peaceful protest. And so he posted things like a meme that said, when you thought you hit a dog, and said, this is great. I think the lack of oxygen from your face diaper has gotten to the last brain cells you had left. It, really. Protesters were crossing the road with the walk now sign in their favor. And he came up behind one individual, swerved around them, and rounded the corner and drove directly into where the protesters were in the crosswalk. And then rolled slowly and deliberately over his victim and then floored it. Now, what's that one song? What is it? Wagon Wheel? Something, 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 something. Johnson City, Tennessee. Right, yeah. And Pettifogger Mac Mead said, "Our client, my client found himself in the wrong place at the wrong time, faced with what he perceived as a dangerous condition, dangerous situation. His entire family, his wife and his three young kids under the age of six, were all in the car with him, and he did what he felt was necessary to get out of a situation that he felt was dangerous to his family." The protesters, there were all of 10 of them. And none of them were anywhere near the automobile. Yeah, except for the one guy who was under the automobile with the automobile on top of him crushing his legs and giving him a concussion and a brain bleed. And meanwhile, again, the effects of stochastic terrorism, because Jared Laffer was one of those people who was soaking up like a sponge, soaking up the right-wing meme of "run them over, run them over, run them over." In fact, the Daily Beast points out that Fox News TV Rwanda, Radio Rwanda, in 2017, published an article whose headline read, "Here's a reel of cars plowing through protesters trying to block the road." The author of the story said, "Study the technique. It may prove useful in the next 4 years." Eventually, they tried to scrub the story, but it was too late. That was after Heather Heyer was murdered by a Trump supporter in Charlottesville, Virginia. Good God. And he will never pay any sort of penalty for it. Because, frankly, the prosecuting attorney will not go back for a second bite of the apple. No. Well, I'll be damned. I didn't know that. Ron and Raleigh says, "You'll be happy to know that today is Vlad Putin's birthday. Vladdy is 69 years young today. Happy birthday. I wonder if Dolt 45 sent him a card." Probably. Probably not just a card.
Might have sent him a, you know, a gift certificate for a free weekend at Mar-a-Lourdes.
Stochastic terrorism, Tom in sunny San Rafael says, "Perhaps it's more like a Predator drone or a cruise missile. You have absolutely no idea where it's going to kill. Much more remote than a grenade." Truth. Truth that. Thank you, Tom. That works better. Much better. Thank you to Ralphs. Ralphs has gotten Rico and DeBerg's Fuck Joe Manchin, and let's add in Kirsten Cinnabon for good measure challenge. There's $20 to go on that. Thank you, Ralphs. And with any luck at all, we'll get that knocked down, and that'll go a long way toward helping us finish off Tuesday's fundraising. Thank you. Thank you. By the way, a little announcement. I should have mentioned this at the beginning of the program, but I was late to the air because of the aforementioned hold. I think I was bounced around the entire Pacific Rim trying to get an answer to my question. Basically, the question is whether the pre-authorization had gone through, because I'm sitting on pins and needles and hung on tenterhooks and hanged on tenterhooks and walking on eggshells and all of those other cliches, waiting to find out about whether or not these assholes are going to approve something that, well, I desperately need in order to continue the rest of my life. Yeah, that was mentioned too, Flavio. What about that flurry of legislation excusing vehicular homicide against protesters? Oh yeah, the article mentions the state of Oklahoma stand, among others. Yeah. Now, if you were curiously, those statutes, as they were promulgated, I'm sure, would not apply if someone, and our side doesn't do this anyway, were to plow over a group of, say, anti-vaxxers and spreadnecks and COVIDiots and mask holes wearing red maggot hats. Oh, no, that, by God, that would be vehicular homicide, without a doubt. Mm-hmm. You know it. And so, right on time, because as a professional, Dan Fisher is nothing if not prompt. Dan Fisher joins us now. Hey, Dan, how are you? It has been way too long.
It has been way too long.
But you're a you're a working professional, and I understand that.
Well, I haven't been a working professional since about mid-September, and I'm waiting for the next job, which is supposed to start at the end of this month. We'll see.
Are you like Daffy Duck in that one cartoon where he's playing Duck Drake, Private Eye, and he says he walks to the window with an empty case of beer bottles and said, "I had just finished an old case. I needed a new case."
That's a good one. And you can watch all of those on HBO Max, by the way. All of those.
I know. Isn't it just grand?
So if you ask, you know, what are you doing these days, with this free time? Well, one of the things I do is watch old Looney Tunes and Popeye on HBO Max. It's really great. There's another Looney Tunes thing that I sometimes sing on days like this, which is, "Working can wait. This is paradise. Having no work to do." Although the truth is, it's kind of driving me crazy. I like work. I'm a working kind of guy.
Yeah, and especially in the midst of a pandemic.
Yeah.
Because it's not like you can go out to Coney Island or something and just mingle amongst the huddled masses.
I can't even go for a walk in my local mall, which I used to do a long time. I may never do that again. And, you know, listen, you know, let's not bemoan the mall too much. But it's indoors and it's warm in the wintertime. So I kind of like doing that before. But that's among the many things I can't do anymore since the assholes and morons are intent on killing me one way or the other. You know, I still have to wear this so-called face diaper. You know,
face diaper. You got to say it with the accent, Dan. It's a face diaper.
Face diaper. Diaper.
Ooh, I like the way your voice cracked there. That was it. You have not forgotten your hillbilly roots.
Well, gee, thanks, Ms. Kincaid. Mr. Douglas. Arnold wants to go to the fair. I'm channeling Pat Buttram. Where did that come from?
We're off and running. Well, it's any day here because of, you know, make West Virginia great big old Governor Jim Justice. In no way, shape, form, or fashion will that COVID-19 booster cause you to grow antlers any more than the original shot did, and it didn't.
Well, in that regard, your dear governor is like the broken clock. He's right about something at least twice a day, I guess. You know, what's the dog's name? Baby doll? Or
baby dog.
Like that?
Baby dog. Do it for baby dog.
Do it for baby dog. I listen. I'm on team baby dog when it comes to vaccines.
Oh, I know.
Yeah,
I just grieve. I grieve for that poor canine. Hauls it around like a sack of taters.
They probably like fill the dog's dish with little tidbits of coal. Don't you think?
Well, if it's good, absolutely. Cold. It's good for West Virginia. It's good for baby dog.
It's good to go down the lungs of the miners and the families that. That live with them, then it's good for a dog, right?
Yeah, precisely. So apart from that, I mean, you've been doing well?
Doing okay. Yeah, you know, it's with the heart transplant of 3 years ago, it's 3 years now.
Wow.
Yeah, September 20th was my birthday 3.0. I got the sucker in September 20th, 2018. And still doing fine, I think, you know. Still chugging along. But you know, between the transplant and the COVID you know, the pandemic hiatus and stuff, I've had some time, a lot of time around the house. So I've gotten sort of a sneak preview of what might lie beyond when I do retire in about 7 years or so from glorious, glamorous show business. But I'm not retired yet. And hope, maybe, let's see, maybe in 7 years I can go indoors to a restaurant and sit down and have people serve me and take away my dishes. I haven't had that pleasure in about 2 years. Thank you, fuckwads. Am I allowed to say fuckwads?
All you want to, especially you, Dan.
Okay. I do have a I can't call him a friend, but it was you know, I grew up in a town, as you know, with a very, very small town with 850 people in it or so. I think at the time it was actually fewer than that. It was like 750 people in the 1970s. And there was a guy I can't really call a friend, but he was just always there. You know, I knew him in first grade. I graduated with him my senior year. And, you know, I can't call him an enemy. I didn't hate him. I don't know if he hated me.
Acquaintance? Acquaintance?
An acquaintance. Yeah, an acquaintance. We didn't like each other much, but I think by and large we stayed out of each other's way. I mean, he chewed his tobacco and he hunted. And I, you know, good friend, that makes you happy to do that stuff. Well, anyway, the reason I bring up this friend whose name I won't drop or mention is that because I've been following for the past 4 weeks on Facebook some of the classmates who haven't unfriended me or me unfriended them for their political beliefs. He got the COVID. He got the Rona. And it was really bad. And it looked really, really horrible for him that he was going to not make it through. But for the first week or two, he couldn't even get into a hospital. He was stuck in the ER for like almost 2 weeks, and then they finally
Dear
got
God.
Him down to a hospital in Parkersburg, and he was on the whole thing. He's on the he had heart issues too, so he was on both a defibrillator and on a what's the oxygen thing? I'm playing
the
password
vent,
here.
The vent, the horizontal crucifixion.
Yeah. Yeah, the ventilation. He was on ventilation, the intubation. He was intubated as well as, you know, the whole deal. He was on death's door. And every day I've had to read about, like, all glory to God, Jimmy's coming out of it. Well, his name is Jimmy. You learn that at least. And it looks like Jimmy's going to make it. I'm happy for Jimmy. But from what I understand, his family and friends will still not get vaccinated because they're giving all credit and all glory to God. And it's like, listen, God's great. And, you know, if God had anything to do with Jimmy making it, you know, good job there, God. You did what you're supposed to do. I appreciate that. But, you know, Jimmy occupied a hospital bed for about 4 weeks, you know, took up all of the time of the doctors and nurses around him. Who knows how much went out in insurance payments. There are people probably lined up waiting for that bed when Jimmy was done with it. He's still not done with it yet. It's like, you know, first of all, let's give a little credit to those doctors and nurses. I mean, you know, God gets a lot of credit and justly so. But, you know, doctors and nurses, they're not chopped liver. They do good things. And might give some praise to them. And you know what? You know, it's kind of on you there, Jimmy and family. If you don't get vaccinated, you know, maybe somebody else died because Jimmy was taking up the bed all that time. Who knows?
Well, and while God was paying attention to Jimmy, apparently, you know, a few thousand other people didn't get his attention and therefore went on to their long home.
Yes. Yes, this is true. So, you know, that's a listen, I'm glad anybody survives it. I don't want to ever get it. I don't know if we've talked about it. Have we talked about it? I did get a third vaccination. I got a booster.
Not on the program we haven't. You're boosted and I'm boosted too. And so too is Agnes.
Well, my case was, you know, as maybe some newbies to the show, you know, the regulars know it, can probably recite it along with me as if I'm doing Rocky Horror Picture Show here. But I was a heart transplant patient. I went in 3 years ago and a couple of 3 years and a month ago, got a brand new 28-year-old heart, which would now be, I guess, a 31-year-old heart in my chest. But because of that, I have to take immunosuppressants every day for the rest of my life because my body has to be told that the heart is not a foreign enemy. It's your friend. Don't attack it. Don't kill it. Let it live. But because of this, I am especially, especially susceptible to germs and viruses of all kind. COVID in particular, I have 1 in 3 heart transplant patients who get COVID die of COVID. So the odds are pretty shitty for those of us. And I promise I'll try not to curse too much tonight, but the odds are pretty shitty.
Wear it out. No, stop that. No. This is a not safe for work program. It is not child friendly. You do you.
See, what you guys don't know, and thank goodness this isn't on Zoom, I'm naked right now. I'm Starkers, and it's all sticking out.
This radio community is absolutely numb to that because I've been doing naked radio for years.
I'm just lying. I'm fully clothed, but I love the fact that I can.
Oh, I'm not.
Yeah, you know, bless you. Whatever you got these days, let it fly, let it flap, let it flutter in the breeze. What can I tell you? Speaking of that, how's it going with you, your body?
Yeah, okay-ish. I mean,
I just flipped it a sec, and I thought I'd flip it. I felt a little like.
No, that's perfect.
We're talking about me.
I was late to the air this evening, and I feel terrible about it, and I'll probably try to make up for it by running a little overtime this evening so we get the full 3 hours in.
Ooh, we love doing that.
I was on the phone. I've got a full 8-hour work day in now with my insurance company. Just trying to find out the barest and most basic information, and they suck. They really, really suck a lot.
You know what? I think I heard part of this. You were talking about this on the show earlier today.
Yeah, just a little bit. Yeah, I was on. And I'd been on the phone for.
I just tuned in when you were.
Yeah, I'd been on the phone for over an hour, and so I was late getting started because I did not want to run that. I did not want to go through that entire hour long, miserable, hateful. Craptastical, absurdist process again.
Yeah.
But as it turned out, when I finally got someone who told me that they were terribly, 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 terribly unable to help me, well, then we started the program, and I realized, yes, I'm doing it all over again tomorrow.
I feel for you. I do. I've been there in some form or another myself. Where you have to start it all over again. You have to start the whole story. Again, it becomes like a song.
Yeah, I mean, you begin to feel like Homer standing there with his little harps and sing me, O Muse.
Yeah.
And
friends, Romans, countrymen, you know, you get it down after a while. I can, you know, I've got like the 3-minute heart transplant set. I've got the 5-minute set if you got time for it. You know, I got the 60 seconds with Johnny set heart story.
You got the elevator 15 second heart transplant story.
I got the pitch. You know, I got the 15 second pitch me high concept thing. I can do it all, and I'm sure you can do the same with your body parts being what they are.
But the thing is, I mean, and it's not a but. It's not disjunctive. The reason I need to know all of this is because the surgery is scheduled for November 9th. And that is 1 month and 2 days from now.
And they want to know, usually, before you go into it, can this be paid for?
Yeah, they're big on that. And it's not a charity hospital. And I've been paying through the nose for insurance coverage, and I'm paying even more now, and can't get a straight answer out of the little bastards. But the thing is, as you well know, you didn't just have a heart transplant and walk out the next day with a smile on your lips and a song in your heart. It was a little while before they let you leave.
This is true.
And so Agnes will be down there with me. She will be my caregiver. And we have to get a place to live for 6 weeks. And the sooner one is able to do that, the more likely it is one is able to find said place. Because, of course, I'm going to be dealing with Airbnb. That is by no means an unpaid product placement.
Of course not.
And
I think you have any of those, do you?
No. No, I do unpaid product placements from time to time.
I tried to get a friend who has a barbecue sauce, by the way, to be a sponsor on your show and even send you something for free, and she just never got around to it.
I'll be happy to pitch it if she sends a bottle. I mean, no money need change hands.
Well, money's not a terrible thing. It wouldn't be a bad thing. National exposure for her.
No, but if she's a startup, she probably doesn't have a bunch of ready cash laying around, and that's fine. But the bottom line is, I found a place, and I'm terrified. I'm concerned that by the time they finally say yes, it'll be like the day before I'm supposed to leave, and it'll be gone because this was perfect. It was a little apartment. It's within a 5-minute walk of the University of Alabama Birmingham Medical Center. And it's everything we need. And it's, of course, exorbitantly expensive. But nonetheless, it beats the hell out of being 30 minutes out of town. Because, among other things, Agnes is going to have to go back and forth. Because I'm going to be laid up for anywhere from 5 to 7 days in the hospital. And I'm really just not looking for. It's one thing, as you well know, and you can address this far better than I. It's much more pleasant, and I think beneficial probably to convalesce at home or something that resembles home, than sitting there trying to in a hospital you can't get a night's sleep.
No, you can't. You cannot.
You know I think they come in and they turn up the sound on the machine that goes ping.
You beat me to that joke. I was waiting for you to take a breath so I could do the machine.
Ha-ha! Victory is mine.
Damn you. Damn you all to hell. Just kidding. I love you.
I love you, too. And so I'm probably going to be just, like, wasted, exhausted by the time I get out of there. And so, all of that. And none of that can happen until they say yes.
Well, it's back on the phone with you tomorrow. Or are you going to start at like 9 a.m. sharp? Like as soon as it's 9, that phone rings?
I may start at 6 because, it's not like they're going to be in the same time zone with me. It may be early afternoon cocktail hour where I'm calling if I call at 6.
That's true.
And I don't mean to sound like some sort of xenophobic asshole, because I'm not. I mean, I have so much respect for anybody who speaks a second language.
Because, I speak only one, so yeah. I share that respect.
Yeah, the time and the technology and everything, you don't often get the best transmission in the world, and so you're sitting there, and I've got tinnitus from years and years and years of broadcasting and wearing headphones, and so I'm straining and straining to make sure that I hear the right words. But I do, because, I'm certainly not one of those maggot America firsters. But there are people who could be trained to do this job in the United States of America, don't you think?
Oh yeah, I mean, don't blame the workers; blame the people who hired the workers and are paying them probably a pittance. They hired them to save money from not having to pay American workers what we consider a fair rate.
Right, and being insurance companies, they probably deliberately set up the offshore call center. Because they know there are a lot of people who will simply give up out of monumental frustration.
I'm sure it factors in. They'll get you one way or the other. They want, the job is to hold on to the money. I can't even explain to you how, I don't hate my insurance company. Because my insurance company, for whatever reason, I'm sure they've spent millions of dollars on me. I feel like Steve Austin.
We can rebuild him. We have the technology.
The $6 million, but I wouldn't be surprised if, like, let's say, $2 million have been spent on my my survival for the
past. If not the $6 million man, you're the seven-digit man.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the $6 million man at a discount. I'm the dollar store $6 million man. I'm the plastic action figure that your grandma gets you and tells you it's just as good as G.I. Joe.
And it never is.
It never is, Grandma. You mean well.
Yeah. You try. At least you tried, Granny. Jeremy in Vermont says, hey, Dan, glad you're well. What's this breaking news that this isn't a family program and not safe for work? I call bullshit. That's well played, Jeremy.
Well, Jeremy from Vermont, I'm curious if you're in the Burlington area, because that is where my son, Augustus, happens to be working and living right now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he is a journalist for the Burlington Free Press and has been doing it for over a month now, and is very happy, writes stories every day, and then also edits, creates videos which get posted on average about once a week. And the subjects tend to go from, like, pumpkin festivals and changing colors of the leaves to, like, real issues and stuff. But it does tend to have a how does this affect us in Vermont slant. But I'm a big fan now of the Burlington Free Press, and I look forward to going up there sometime, hopefully at the end of this month, to visit myself. I've not been there. So,
how will you do that safely?
Well, I can go to hotels. We have to like be very careful. I've done it a couple of times where, we ask the right questions. Can you, what's the cleaning procedure and, all of that stuff. And if there's a lobby to get to, there's workarounds. And, I did get my third vaccine. And actually, let me just jump back real quick.
Yes, please.
To mention something too, which is that one of the reasons I have my third vaccine is not only because I'm immunocompromised, which I am, but I actually, after I'd gotten my first two, 6 months later, I got an antibody test, and the bad news came in that basically it didn't work for me. It just didn't happen. The meds I take are too strong and kind of knocked out the whole effect of the first two. So I took a third. I have no idea if that's going to do any good either. The grim fact might be that as strongly pro-vaccination as I am, it might not have an effect on me, and that's by necessity. If I weaken my meds, then I risk my body rejecting my heart, and I need the heart. You need that. I can't go to the Wizard of Oz for another one. So I get especially mad at people who just can't not only refuse to get vaccinated, but try to continue spreading the lies. The proof is everywhere. The proof should be incontrovertible and so stunningly obvious. I mean, just looking at the death rates, but then it'll be like, well, and listen, I have a friend. I have a very good friend and coworker who is, for whatever his own reasons, and he's not a MAGA. He's actually black and he's a Muslim. But I know that Muslims do allow vaccinations. So I don't know what his deal is, but he is anti-vax. And when I tried to give him the numbers of unvaccinated death rates, he's like, well, I have my own numbers. I don't agree. I think that he told me with a straight face, I think the majority of those dying right now are the vaccinated. So it's like, what are you going to do? You can't, they simply say, I refuse to accept data. Data is not real to me. Here's my
That's the la 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 can't hear you argument.
But what's the point after a while? What's the fucking point?
Well, see, I'm speculating here, but I think it is a speculation with a fair grounding in reality. I think where the black community is concerned, and we've had some conversations about this.
Yeah, it's Tuskegee. I know that.
Yeah, exactly. It's Tuskegee, and even within the Tuskegee rubric, that has been twisted. There are people who think that the Tuskegee experiment actually gave people African-American men syphilis and then didn't treat them. No, these were guys who went out and got it all by themselves, but they did a study and some people got treated and some people didn't. And, and with something like syphilis, that's horribly, horribly unethical. And it's
Absolutely.
Brutal. But it has been spread like wildfire by, among other people, and shame on him, and I know it causes great grief to the wider family, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Yeah.
He has become an absolute pariah, and he deliberately tries to take his anti-vax, it's just a shitty little documentary, into African-American communities to try to keep people from getting vaccinated. That sounds like something the Klan would do.
Here's what gets me, too. And we'll talk about other things, I promise. But, you know, every time I've gotten into these things, first of all, every time I get into any kind of discussion on this, I have to say in my head first, okay, do you really have a couple hours out of your day to devote to this? Like, especially if it's an online thing, it's going to take a minimum of 3 hours out of my day. So if it's a day like I have today where I'm not working, sometimes I go there because it's like, you know what? I can go into the trenches as long as they can. And no mistake, by the way, too, anti-vaxxers and MAGAs, one thing they have in common, they view online quote-unquote debate as a war of attrition. Whoever gets the last word in wins, and winning is all that really matters. While the bodies pile up all around them, all they care about is winning online, as if you get a cookie for that. I can't remember. I'm so angry about it. I just lose my train of thought so easily. But, doctors. That's it, too. When I just say very plainly, look, doctors saved my life. Doctors took another man's heart, stuck it into my chest, sewed it all up, gave me the meds to live for the rest of my life. You think I'm going to, like, say to them, nah, I think I'm going to listen to the guy with that interesting YouTube video. No, I'm going to listen to the people who literally, literally saved my life. So doctors, rah-rah doctors. And then, of course, the opposition goes, well, here's my doctor. And they say that, you know, vaccines are killing people. And it's like, wait a minute. You know, we know by now that every rule has an exception. Every fact has an outlier. So, yeah, there is going to be like that foot surgeon down in Florida who's anti-vax, or the chiropractor in Minneapolis or whatever.
Or the real or the real live doctor in the suburbs of Houston who says that we all need to be drinking bleach and taking hydroxychloroquine, and that demons steal men's penises and bury them under the sea at night.
Oh, well, there's another one of those doctors that stood with that. I know which one you're talking about. There was another one at that press conference that I think was also facing charges now for the January 6th thing. She was there that day, of course. But, you know, this is what I say, too, about all of these supposed, you know, outlier doctors. Because, by the way, too, you know, every doctor's organization, every medical organization and scientific organization you can imagine wholeheartedly endorses vaccinations, you know, the AMA, the Pediatric Society, etc. But if 100 doctors are walking down the street together, you know, let's say after convention, 100 doctors are walking down the street, they come upon a really weird looking object on the sidewalk ahead of them. 99 doctors bend down, look at it and say, looks like poop, smells like poop, it's poop. One doctor looks at it and says, no, I think it's a Snickers bar. Are you really going to go with the Snickers bar doctor? Are you going to pick up that poop and do what I think you're going to do?
Well, if Donald Trump endorses the Snickers bar theory, by God, the entire maggot nation will be munching on poo.
They'll put Divine to shame when it comes to that. Did you get that reference?
Yeah, I got that reference, and that's really, okay. That's a shot right across the bow at people dining in the Central Daylight Time Zone right now.
Okay, by the way, for non super film nerds like myself and perhaps Robin, Divine starred in these movies by a director named John Waters, and in one of them called Polyester, Divine, who is I think it's transvestite in this case. Am I right?
Drag queen.
Divine was a drag queen, and in one scene in a movie called Polyester, he literally picked up a piece of dog poop and ate it for the benefit of the camera. And it's there for you to watch it with your family, I'm sure, streaming on all platforms whenever you care to. dinner time, you know, with grandma.
And that's a nice segue. We'll get to it at some point. Streaming on all platforms. Because that whole idea of streaming media is right smack dab in the middle of your very world right now, isn't it?
It is indeed. Let's see. Do I give you the elevator? Do I give you the 3 minutes?
No. We got an hour and a half to work with here. We want all the details.
Okay. Well, some people think it was Thomas Edison who invented the film projector, but in fact, many people think it's
Skip
brothers.
A bit, brother.
Okay. So, I belong to
Sergei Eisenstein with the magnificent film The Battleship Potemkin. Yes.
And let us discuss the birth of a nation, and it's problematic. And yet, no. We'll stick with what I know really well. Which is I'm a member, which is me. I know myself pretty damn well. I belong to a union called the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees of United States and Canada. And I think it's also projectionists and all kinds of other addendums to that. But it's IOTC for short. And IOTC is the overall union for it's international. It's us, it's Canada, it's Mexico. And then we have different locals. I am in Local 52, which represents New York, Connecticut, Philadelphia, New Jersey. It's a pretty big local. We have about 4,000 members in our particular local. And we work under contracts, usually three-year contracts. And every time 3 years comes around, our representatives and the representatives of studios and producers, they all sit down together and they work out the next contract in terms of what's our rate going to be, what are the contributions toward pension and welfare and health insurance, what about rest breaks and meal breaks, what can we expect or should be expected of us in these areas and many other areas as well. And you might have heard on the news, you might not have, or you might not really have understood it. There has been an impasse, let us say, between 13 locals, mostly West Coast affiliated, and the Producers Association known as the AMPTP, which is something American something producers of theatrical something or others. But they represent motion pictures and especially streaming networks, streaming platforms, I should say. Right now, their contract is up. The contract has actually been up for those 13 locals for months, I think since May. So they've been working all of these months without a contract. And during that time, the representatives for both sides have been negotiating, going back and forth, and not being able to come to an agreement. Among the issues that have been in contention, one is what's called turnaround time. That is, you know, in our business, and I think I've talked about this in the past, you know, it's a fun business. What I've been doing for most of my life is fun work. It's hard work, but I enjoy it, and I enjoy the product that it creates, and I feel invested emotionally. And as a viewer, I love to watch movies and love to watch television. So it's really great that I've been able to do this for my life's work. And I think most others who do what I do or in my union or in my local would agree with that. The problem is that, you know, it's a job. And so we want to be treated well. We want to be treated fairly. And it's a very demanding job. For most of my life, I've accepted the idea that a 12-hour workday is a normal workday. Many of you listening might do eight and think that's perfectly enough for any person. There are some I know that do more than eight, that do 10 or whatever. But we usually in the film business can expect at least a 12-hour workday, very often 14, on rare occasions 16 hours in a day. And now you figure, well, if you're working 14, that only gives you, you know, 10 hours left out of a 24-hour day to do something besides work. Well, yeah, that's absolutely true because we're now fighting for what's called turnaround time. That is, if I finish up and I'm done at midnight that night, let's say I work all the way to midnight, my past contracts have said Well, okay, he's got 10 hours of turnaround. You cannot call him in until 10 o'clock the next morning. You know, 10 plus midnight equals 10 a.m. Well, the producers on this particular contract in the West Coast have proposed a 9-hour or in some cases even 8-hour turnarounds. So the idea is that you're doing 2/3 of your day working for them. And 8 hours total is devoted to driving wherever you drive to, sleeping for as long as you can, probably not seeing your wife or your kids or your spouse or your partner. And if you have kids, seeing those people. When I say you, I really was personalizing for a minute. I have a wife and I have a kids, and I spent a lot of my life not seeing them because I was working. And that's one of my few regrets. But anyway, so that's one of the issues, turnaround time. Producers are proposing less turnaround time than we've had before. They're using COVID very often to justify this and other things I'll talk about, that we were shut down for so long that when we did come back, at first the promise was going to be, well, we're going to give you shorter days and more rest time because we realize that in order to stay healthy, rest is important. Well, that went out the window very, very shortly when they realized, oh, shit, we don't have a whole lot of content on our platform. We need to ramp up production. So production ramped up, but then the hours increased. And so suddenly that 12 hours of normalcy I was telling you about, which is kind of crazy as it is, well, now 14 has become the new normal. Workers are expected to work 14 hours and sometimes more and get less than 10 hours between stopping work and going right back into it.
And this isn't just a leisure issue. I mean,
no, it's a survival issue. It's,
but is it also not, Dan, on, you know, when you're on the job site, is it also not rather a significant safety issue? When people are exhausted, people make mistakes.
They do, and sometimes those mistakes hurt them. I did once a 20-hour day on a pilot for a show. Between I had to come in early to prep. It was a big party scene. We went way over in shooting. I think we did a 16-hour day. And by the time I left, I clocked in 20 hours. I drove home, and about a half a mile from my house, I must have just in my head, I must have told myself that I could close my eyes from there. I've got it. And I wrecked my car. I drove off the road into a ditch. Luckily missed a tree by a couple of feet. And walked away. You know, the car was pretty screwed up, but I was lucky. I came out of it okay. But you know, no hotel rooms were offered. No second meal was being offered. You know, food can keep you awake. Calories, you know, hot coffee, any of that stuff. No, it was just like, well, thanks for the hard work, guys. We'll see you in 10 hours. Go home. And yeah. So I've personally experienced that. People in our field have died driving home after those kind of hours. It's just, we're not machines. And, you know, much has been made about, we do. Listen, I'm not in a competition with other workers of any other fields. I get that there's shitty working conditions everywhere in all fields. You know, a lot of the shows I work for are being produced by Amazon. And we know how terrible Amazon treats its workers. But I get overtime. I get time and a half after 8 hours. After 14 hours, I get double time. But, you know, all of that money doesn't mean a whole lot if I'm not around to survive it.
Yeah, and often it gets, just because of the way the tax code's written, that double time or time and a half gets eaten up.
That's true, too. That's true. But also too, in our industry, I mean, it seems to me, I've not done any real research on this, but it seems to me that those who do what I do, we don't have a long life expectancy. I can't tell you how many times I open up my union newsletter and it's like somebody who just retired like a year or two previously, they're gone. You know, this person dead before retirement. You know, it's a very demanding job. And I've said it before, we're creating entertainment. We're not doing surgery. We're not landing airplanes. We're not going to battle. What we're doing is providing entertainment. But yet, believe you me when I tell you that the people who make it take it very, very seriously. We're creating a product which makes which can be very expensive to produce. But the upshot is that when it comes out, it can make a lot of people very, very rich. So there's a lot of pressure on those of us who help produce this product to make it quickly, cheaply, and all the other things. And it's there's a lot of emotional stress in creating it is where I'm going with it. So anyway, how this relates to what's going on in the labor thing is, yes, so turnaround is one issue. Another thing is that you mentioned streaming. And what's changed in the landscape a lot since I started working in film and TV back in 86, of course, is streaming and how movies and television are consumed and what even is television. I mean, you know, Ted Lasso is a television show, but, you know, it's not on the net. You know, it used to be television was network television. Now, of course, it's you can watch television on your phone. So, it's not even a television. It's phone. You're watching phone. You're not watching television. You're watching laptop, you know. But so when this came in the early 2000s, the idea that you would be able to watch something on your phone or your computer, at first a lot of the networks and stuff really fought against it. You know, the NBC TV was like filing lawsuits against YouTube and not letting any of their content go out on any kind of streaming because they're like, well, if people watch stuff on their computers, they won't watch it on their TVs. And how are they going to be able to watch our commercials and how can we monetize it?
Well, yeah, it's the same old Hollywood versus the videotape war.
Yeah.
And they're always on the wrong end of the future.
Right. Well, you know, eventually somebody figured out how to make a profit by it. Let me put it that way. Now you've got a gazillion streaming platforms and new ones come out seemingly every month. And a lot of them are great. I don't have cable TV anymore. I subscribe to a number of the platforms and I love a lot of the stuff being produced. Excuse me one moment while I take a sip of water.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'll just add that, ever since we started watching it, I've been singing the praises of Ted Lasso. It's some of the best TV or small screen format, whatever you want to call it, that I've ever seen.
But I haven't seen it yet, believe it or not, because I don't have. I join Apple whenever I work on an Apple show. I'll join it and then I'll watch my show and then I'll quit because there's not that much stuff on the platform compared to some of the other stuff. I feel I get more bang for my buck watching HBO Max. Or even the Evil Empire at Amazon Prime than I do Apple. But I just a show I worked on is coming out. I'm about to start an Apple TV show, hopefully, at the end of this month. So I'll get it again. And I'll watch Ted Lasso. I hear it's wonderful.
It just is.
Here's the point, is that things have changed a whole hell of a lot since 2000. But we are still – the contracts that those people are right now arguing about on the West Coast and we'll get to me, believe you me, about how it affects me because I'm not on the West Coast. I'm in New York. But the issues – the contract that they're currently renegotiating is called, I kid you not, the New Media Contract, as if all of this is brand new. And originally when the New Media Contracts began in the early 2000s, the producers asked for and got lots of free goodies. They got breaks on rates. We brought our rates down to accommodate for this and contributions to pension and welfare, all kinds of stuff, because the argument then was this is all new. We have no idea if we're going to make any money at it. So cut us a break, why don't you? We're just trying to figure this stuff out. Well, it's 2021 and the game's over. You guys won. You did figure out how to make a profit from it and then some. And plus, you know, you're owned by Amazon, which owns everything, and Apple, which owns the rest. So there should be no need for this new media idea anymore, that you aren't new media, you're media. You know, NBC TV, CBS, those are old media, and those are also
legacy media.
You know, they launch their own streaming platforms because they know the future too. So one of our arguments as workers under this contract is, why are we working under a new media contract? This isn't new media at all. And we're tired of giving away freebies and parts of our pension fund, underfunding our pension fund because Amazon's crying poverty. I actually just this morning, I kid you not, got called. Somebody didn't know that I've been out of the prop master business for 3 years. Somebody called me to see if I wanted to work on a low budget tier one, which is the lowest budget you can have, a tier one Netflix movie. And I turned it down, and I actually had the balls to say, besides the fact I can't do it because I don't prop master anymore, thank you to the heart, but I had the balls to say to them, I don't believe there should be such a thing as a tier one Netflix job. You know? What's
no,
the point?
Because it's Netflix.
Netflix has all the money. It's Netflix. You make a half. Netflix has how many? They have two. I think 200 million. No, 20 million subscribers. 20 million subscribers, and they're raising their rates. No, 200 million subscribers. The upshot is they make almost $500 million a month in subscriber income. $500 million a month. So no, I won't do a tier one Netflix movie. You know, I used to do tier ones movies back in the day. That was because it was like some kid out of NYU that raised the money off his credit card and had a really great script.
And you wanted to give them a shot,
right? And I love independent low budget film. I watch tons of it and I support it. It gave me my business, my start, and as a viewer, I think it's some of the best stuff out there. But no, Netflix, you're not that kid from NYU. You're Netflix. Pay, give us the money. But, yeah, and some of the other demands being met with the West Coast contract are we've been getting a 3%. It's been customary for us to have a 3% wage increase for every year to supposedly keep up with inflation, which doesn't really keep up with inflation.
No.
But I know it's better than a lot of other groups, so it hasn't been so terrible. But the producers, of course, of Amazon, Apple, Paramount Plus, Disney, they're proposing, because of this new media, which maybe won't make a whole lot of money, who knows, they're proposing we take a 2.5% in the first year, and no, 2% in the first year and 1.5% in the second and third year of this contract.
That's going backwards.
That's going backwards. Oh, and they also want to change the number of hours required for us workers to almost double to qualify for health insurance and pension credits.
Yeah, because
so
they hate those
as much in pension.
Because so you've got a real pension, right?
We've got a real pension. We're I'm blessed to have a pension. I know this. My older sister Lori works in a steel factory. She's worked there for decades now in their payroll department. She will not have a pension when she retires this year. It's criminal. Everybody should get something. You put in all that time, you hear the we're all just one big family speech over and over at the company picnic or party, and yet they won't give you a pension. What's up with that?
Well, the bottom line is that pensions went the way of the dodo when the geniuses from the Harvard School of Business realized that they could put that on the roulette wheel on Wall Street.
Yeah. Well, listen, I'm the grandson of Frank Enslin. Frank Enslin worked at, who was my mom's father. Frank Enslin worked at J&L Steel in Pittsburgh for I don't know how many years, because I'm terrible with my family's history. But this I do know, J&L Steel forced my grandpa Enslin to retire early, basically so they could screw him out of a pension. Yeah. I think he got a minimal amount, and good luck to you, Frank.
Reynolds Metals Company did the same thing to my father.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I know that every employer, no matter what you do, every employee, no matter what you do, at some point in your life, you're going to hear the we're all family speech. And whenever you hear that speech, you know, you get your hackles up right away.
Grab your wallet.
Grab your wallet. You know.
Yeah, we're all family. We're all family, but the working people are the poor relations.
That's right.
On purpose.
So, yeah, so there's a lot of issues at stake, and for the first time in almost 50 years, the locals of IATSE voted for what's called a strike authorization. Now, this does not mean that we're on strike yet, and I'm not on strike because it's not my local. But if in the coming next 2 or 3 weeks of negotiations that this might take, if our representatives really feel like they can't get anywhere further to having their demands met or their requests met, they can call a strike. And the West Coast IATSE locals, which number around 60,000 employees, will go on strike. So all film, television, streaming production that's made in Los Angeles and the Western areas is suddenly stopped. Now, my local, 52, and those of us on the East Coast, our contract is up in about 3 weeks. At the end of October, our very similar contract is up. So if that issue is not resolved by our brothers and sisters, we will have a similar thing. We will call for a strike authorization vote, and I have every reason to believe we'd endorse it. The by the way, too, when the vote was called by those 13 locals, over 90% of the members participated in the vote, and the yes to strike authorization vote is almost 99%. So it was a landslide, and this is unprecedented. Very often, I can tell you personally, it's hard to get people to show up at union meetings or to vote, let alone 99%. Voting overwhelmingly for anything. So,
well, and there's another angle to this that I've read in some reports is deemed to be somewhat surprising, and that is that a lot of big name on screen talent is saying, "Yeah, strike, really, please."
Yeah, yeah. Well, the strike will be. I mean, listen, it's very. I appreciate that. I really do. When Danny DeVito or Tina Fey or whoever, you know, post their picture wearing the union, Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin union solidarity shirts. I appreciate that. I enjoy it. And it helps spread the word to all kinds of people, perhaps people who don't follow the industry like I do for obvious reasons. But on the other hand, too, when the time comes, will they cross the picket line? Will they go to New Zealand? Will they go to someplace where they can still make the product? Or will they really be unified with us and say, you know, if until you get those camera people and those grips and electrics back on the job, we're not on the job. If they could do that, that would be huge, because really, you know, there's a few things that really matter a lot to any production that have the ability to shut down a production for real. And one of them, the big one, is talent. When you lose the talent, you know, you sometimes lose the entire production. You know, entire productions go away because you thought you had Tom Hanks and then you didn't have Tom Hanks. And then the other is location, you know. So we will need that support when the time comes for real. Hopefully they'll give it. I'm an optimist.
And it seemed to me, standing, of course, at a great distance, Dan.
Yeah.
It seemed to me, though, that was a clear signal to management that the talent is on board. I mean, I'm an optimist too where this is concerned, because the talent are union workers too. I mean,
right.
They're talent, they're on screen, they're making boatloads more money, but they're members of SAG-AFTRA, right?
Right.
And well, one of the fundamental rules is if one union goes, another union is not going to cross.
We would hope no scab actors or any such thing. And listen, it's, you know, everything's like, oh, once you're an actor, you're a millionaire. I mean, the majority of working actors, I don't know if they make more than $50,000 a year, at least at acting. I have the feeling probably not. You know, I have many actor friends. It's like they get that one scene in Law and Order, and that's the whole work they got as an actor, at least paid work, for the entire year. You know, and yet they're still doing it because they love acting. You know, you can be a Jane Fonda, you can be a, you know, Brad Pitt and make $20 million a movie. But by and large, you know, actors are working folk just like I'm working folk.
Yeah, it's just like, a great example is the NFL. We hear constantly about how much this quarterback makes or that quarterback makes.
Yeah.
It's a lot more... I guess you'd say a workaday if you're talking about, you know, a guard,
right,
or an offensive tackle, and the the work life expectancy, not even talking about head injuries, but bodily injuries, but the work life expectancy of, say, an offensive tackle, no matter how good, is a hell of a lot shorter than it is for a quarterback, because it's a lot harder work. And so that applies as well to acting. And God, not, you know, now the legendary is not the right word, but you know, the person who you know, spends years and years and years waiting tables, and then eventually gets the big break, but then is never heard from again. I mean, and of course, in music, one hit wonders, what have you. By the way, we have to go backwards for just a moment. We have a trivia correction, Dan.
Uh-oh.
Matt in San Francisco says, as to Divine, I think it was pink flamingos, not polyester, where Divine ate the poop.
Oh, you're so correct. Yeah, the P, the alliterative P screwed me up. Yeah, in fact, polyester was sort of where John Waters started to go into the more family-friendly stuff, like hairspray and crybaby and so forth.
And Jeremy in Vermont wanted you to know, yeah, I'm the Jeremy who warned you on the notice on your Facebook page that Augustus was moving to Vermont, that once he moved here, he may never want to leave. And,
yeah.
And he said, actually, Dan, both parties win cookies online. It's how the Internet works, after all. Truth. And you got a note from Tracy. Is Dan's African-American friend unvaccinated in the Nation of Islam? Because if he is, that explains why he's refusing the vaccine. There's a young brother in one of my classes who's a member of the NOI who's an anti-vaxxer. Remember, the Nation of Islam is not the most enlightened bunch. Remember, Malcolm X and eventually Ali left the nation for a reason. Plus, now they're in league with Scientology, you know, that part. Be careful out there, my dear friend, Tracy writes. Every time I hear an anti-vaxxer lie about the vaccine, I immediately think of you and how they literally have your life in their hands, and it really pisses me off. Again, please be careful, my friend. I really like having you around. Love, Tracy.
Oh, Tracy. Tracy, you came and you gave without taking.
Now, that was Mandy, or was it Mindy?
No, it should be Tracy, because Mandy ain't got nothing on Tracy.
No.
Yeah, I think he is Nation of Islam. I don't think he's the other kind. But you know what? What I know about the Islamic faith is shamefully about as much as I know about speaking Spanish, which is un poco, and I should be and am embarrassed about that.
But that's one of the things I do not understand. All of not just Nation of Islam, but. Anti-vaxxing tends to run across various and sundry fundamentalisms. And what I don't get is they've got a fairly limited membership. Why are you trying to bump off your members? Never mind the morality of it. You're killing the goose that lays the golden egg.
If I were a more cynical Machiavellian type political thinker, which I try not very much to be, I would think, you know, for the MAGA, let's own the libs by not doing the vaccine business. It's like, you know, and the fact that 80% of those dying right now are unvaccinated, it's like, you know what? Fewer of you in Georgia, fewer of you in those swing states could make a difference 2022, 2024. You know, I don't want you to die, but if you're not fighting for yourself, how can you expect me to fight for you? I'm rooting for you to live, but you're not. So if you happen not to be able to cast your vote for MAGA 2.0 in 2024, well, gee whiz, you coulda, but you didn't.
And are you familiar, because I've been featuring some of these posts the last several nights, are you familiar, well, one, you're bound to be familiar with Reddit.
I am. I avoid it. I don't do it.
I know. Well, over on Reddit, there is a subreddit called Herman Cain Award.
Oh, yeah.
And they're just cataloging, and they're not being vicious about it, but there are people who now go out and find the social media postings of people who, unfortunately, die of COVID-19. And they don't have to work very hard, Dan.
Nope.
Because the social media postings give everything away. I've got one here in front of me right now. Patrick Hampton, a columnist of The Patriot Post, kills his brother by taking him out of the hospital against medical advice because they refuse to give him ivermectin. He's a public figure who wants his story to go viral. And so, you know, here, part one, more to come. I have hours of this stuff. Erlanger Hospital refused to give my brother the treatment he asked for in addition to their protocols. So we fought like hell to get him out of their death trap to better care. They're killing people with their protocols. Let me be clear. Erlanger refused to give him ivermectin, you know, horse paste, vitamin C through intravenous, vitamin D through intravenous. My brother was near death. And then the memes start. I'm not against nurses and doctors. I'm against the protocols that nurses and doctors are trained to follow without question. Erlanger Hospital gave my family no other choice but to get out because they refused to allow the right to try other medicines and scientific protocols in addition to their NIH and CDC protocols. This is, because it's all caps, this is medical injustice. I'm okay, currently looking for home help.
Can I beg you to stop?
Okay.
I mean, I know that I made the divine eating dog poop story at possibly the family dinner hour, which was distasteful of me. But I got to say, just listening to this makes me sick. It just makes me woozy with anger and wanting to vomit all over this lovely 10-year-old laptop that is still running for whatever reason.
And this is apparently Chattanooga, Tennessee. And so they pulled the guy out. We got my brother away from this hospital.
Yeah.
And then continued to... And eventually they get down to, we need two things, prayer and funds for aggressive meds. You know, there's not much more aggressive meds than what they give in the hospital. By the time you get to the ICU, you're at the state of aggressiveness. And he's still barking and hooting and grunting about vitamin C and horse paste, natural immune system, natural antibody treatments, and then hashtag jab of the beast. Killed his own brother.
Please, no more. This is the last one. I know.
But the thing is, the postings on that subreddit increase almost hourly. And what you don't see there are postings by people saying, you know, we did our best, he got his vaccine, and, well, you know, he got sick, and he was one of the 0.01%, you know, the 1/100th of 1/100th who are vaccinated and die. It's not there. And there seems to be some correlation, Dan, between the willingness to spread this horseshit and the toxicity of it. And it raises cultural questions, not just political questions, but cultural questions, sociological questions, anthropological questions about human behavior.
I get that. I totally understand that. It's this idea of what is strength. How do we, you know, the whole thing of natural immunity too. I've seen a lot of that. Oh, you know, natural immunity will solve all your problems. But first of all, as speaking of a person who does not have natural immunity anymore, I want to live. So please let me live. Please don't kill me. But it's like it's some sort of fucking competition or something. It's like
you're a cult.
Yeah, it's like a chest beating sort of thing. And it's like, you know what? It's okay to seek treatment if you're sick. That doesn't make you weak. You know, it's okay to try to prevent something from getting you sick. That doesn't mean you're living in fear.
You know, we don't get mad at people from the 14th century who walked around with nosegays under their nose, sniffing flowers under some mistaken impression that warded off bubonic plague.
Right.
We simply acknowledge that they were doing the best they could with the information they had at hand. So we don't talk about their stupidity,
right?
Because there was no other viable source of information, and it killed throughout the Eastern Hemisphere. It didn't jump the Atlantic, but there, whatever, or the Pacific. But that situation does not obtain now.
Well, we've gone from living in the information age to the misinformation age extremely quickly.
And deliberately, would you agree? Deliberately?
Oh, it's deliberate. I still don't quite get the angle. I don't get the profit in it. You know, usually I'm cynical enough to think that you know, everything that's this, you know, widespread and this, you know, there's got to be an angle. What's the angle to killing people? What's the angle to spreading this level?
I don't think it's exactly that, Dan. But if you'll work with me here for a second, I think I can put a cute little bow on it. If you go back in time, and Brother Deacon Asa sent me the story a few days ago, at the age of 74, a former member of the House of Representatives from Missouri named Todd Akin, his name might ring a bell for you.
He does ring a bell.
He died having fought a long battle against cancer, and there was no mention of COVID, so, you know, that's not the angle.
All right.
Had a long battle with cancer, died at 74. He became, rather than just a nondescript, never heard of him member of the House of Representatives who didn't make much noise, he became world famous back around 2014, 2015, when he declared, in regard to in the debate at that time, and it centered around back when dead Rush Limbaugh was hollering about Sandra Fluck wants her slut medicine paid for.
Right.
And rather than keeping his mouth closed, he declared that in the cases of legitimate rape,
ding ding ding, that's what bell rings.
Yep. In the case of legitimate rape, a woman's body has a way to shut that thing down. Now, tell me if I'm wrong, but isn't there a bright red line between a woman's body has a way to shut that thing down and natural immunity? Aren't we talking about the same sort of phenomenon? The same sort of fantasy, if you will?
They're definitely cousins. They're definitely cousins. I can tell you that listening to that statement just, you know, it makes me think that, God rest his soul, Todd Akin probably went to his grave never having given a woman an orgasm in his life.
I would not doubt that in the least.
Yeah. Because he don't know women's bodies worth shit.
They're
mysterious things, don't get me wrong.
Mysterious and wonderful, and yes. But there's a mindset in those two instances. There's a mindset that wants to think, if you talk to people who have experience in addiction,
uh-huh,
they will tell you that people will get to the point, regardless of whatever substance it is they're abusing, where they begin to engage in magical thinking. That's mm-hmm. That's the official term for it, magical thinking. And basically, magical thinking is where, regardless of how bad things get, somehow or another, some deus ex machina is going to swing out on the crane and make everything okay. You know, you're going to be able to continue to abuse whatever it is that you abuse, and things are still just going to be okay, and you're not going to spiral down into the depths of personal destruction and the hell of addiction and because magical thinking. It manifests outside the addiction world, for instance, in the people who in people who say, unironically and not kidding, when I win the lottery.
Right.
Because there are people out there who do, you know, when I win the lottery, by God, well, you know, never realizing that the one in, the, you know, it's not like if you play the lottery long enough, it's going to hit. It's one in 290 million every time.
Well, and I don't want to offend any person who has religious faith who listens to your show. I respect religious faith, and my faith is what my faith is. But, I mean, there's a ton of, I'm afraid to say it, there's a ton of that of magical thinking in religion.
Oh, it's defined by it.
It's faith. It's the idea, don't go by what you can see and what you think you know. Go by faith. Go by what you feel is correct. And the thing is it, that might, I don't know. I don't know if I want to go down this road too far.
No, it's okay. If you're worried, let me go there. For instance, all of this Herman Cain Award stuff, the number they all have a certain trajectory, Dan, and it's like, okay, fought it, didn't go to the hospital. Okay, no, it starts with won't get vaccinated, vast conspiracy, got it, tried to fight it at home with orange juice or whatever, went to the doctor. Got put in the hospital, fought it, went on the vent, and then there are posts about how they were able to lower the oxygen saturation today, and blah, 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 blah. And then the next post is took a turn for the worse.
And this is the past 3 weeks of Facebook posts about my old pal Jimmy.
Yeah, yeah, and he is not, he's part of a pattern. That's the whole point. And yeah. But then it gets to, we need prayers, and then the last one is always mom, dad, brother, sister, friend, went home to be with Jesus, and they post it with smiley faces and praying hands emojis, as if they are happy, as if it is somehow a satisfactory outcome. And then comes the GoFundMe page to pay for the funeral.
That's right. Well, look at it this way. Okay, if we invest in magical thinking and we go to the thing of light, you know, as I've seen, some people have said, well, COVID is God's way of showing his displeasure with that society has turned away from him, or that we've taken prayer out of schools. Or
the lesbians, the bisexuals, the gays, the transgender.
If we go that Old Testament route, of God's wrath, right? COVID is God's wrath, or West Virginia. Let's go West Virginia, because that's, you know, West Virginia is another example. Is one of the capitals right now of COVID. It's a COVID capital.
Or yeah, Texas, it's a COVID crockpot. Yes.
And how much of West Virginia is populated by Christians? You know, let's say even evangelical Christians. It's over half. It's probably like 80%. Ain't a whole lot of Jews there. I know this from having lived there. And
no, that was the reason Mel Gibson moved his daddy here.
What's that?
That was the reason Mel Gibson moved his daddy here. Hutton Gibson, Mel Gibson's daddy, he moved to West Virginia back about 20 years ago. I don't know if he's still with us or not. I'm moving to West Virginia because there ain't no Jews there, because there's working people in West Virginia. I'll never forget that, because he lived about 20 miles from me.
But if we apply again that magical thinking thing, it's like, well, how come, you know, if West Virginia and Texas are so beloved by God, they get hit with, majorly by the Rona, and then places like Japan with less than 5%, I believe, Christian population, their numbers are minimal comparatively. So I don't know. God isn't paying attention to Japan, I guess. I can't explain magical thinking. I mean, I do indulge in a little magical thinking myself. Whenever I play Monopoly on my phone, which I do all the time, unfortunately, I do think somehow if I say like certain, like seven, just give me a seven, a seven will appear. And of course, it's not true. But no. We all love magical thinking. It's fun. And
right, but it's when it becomes an integral part of your lifestyle. By the way, you've gotten a note from an old friend.
Uh-oh.
Bob wrote in. And said, I started to say that Dan is an old friend of mine, and I was listening around 7 p.m. on October the 7th. Well, I'm so glad you were, Bob. It's going to be awesome all the way to the end of the conversation. Stick around.
Bob's good friends with Jimmy. And so, Bob, I hope I haven't said anything that sounds malicious to Jimmy. I really do.
No, we're glad he's alive.
Yeah, he's alive. I just wish he'd get vaccinated, and I wish his family wouldn't think that it's God's will to not get vaccinated. But Now, Bob is a perfect person for you to be in your audience. You know, Middleburn, West Virginia.
Yay, Middleburn!
He's fighting the good fight, man. He's like one of the, you know, six people in that town who haven't swallowed the MAGA Kool-Aid. And it's not easy living in a small town.
Lord God, no. I mean,
considers you a communist or whatever else they probably do.
I'm lucky. I've said it before. I'll say it again, that I live where I live because I live in a little blue dot surrounded by blood red. But you know, the same thing obtains all over this state. It's scary as hell. It doesn't, in any random grouping of ten people, you count one for yourself, and that means the other set, or I mean, ten, yeah. So if you're one of 10 people in a random group, you count one, you count yourself, two, three, and the rest of them are MAGA.
Yeah.
And they can be sweet, and they can be kind, and they can even be decent. But if you cross that line, game, it's either game on or game over, baby. And it's sad.
Well, I appreciate kindness and I appreciate decency to my face and otherwise. But listen, you know, I'm white, cisgender, male, etc. I'm in the privilege zone. I know this. But even then, I know that MAGAs are against the things that I, not only that I hold dear, but against my interests. You know, I know.
Well, and their own. I know we talk about this. This is a real kind of a thorny one, Dan. Because we go back and forth on how we handle it. There's this old phrase that gets bandied about, especially among, you know, the progressive people who know so much better than everybody else does, and that's why we're hated so much.
Right.
Why do those people vote against their own best interests? Well, maybe because they don't perceive their best interests the way that we think they should.
Yeah. But I know what my best interest is. You know, my best interest is invested in being a good union worker and doing the things that provide for my family and being paid well and decently and appropriately for that. And, you know, the MAGA administration just raised holy hell on union membership, and they're still fighting to create a national right to work law that would
even though
knock me out.
Donald J. Trump, once again, when he was working on The Apprentice, was a union member. Rush Limbaugh was a union member. Sean Hannity is a union member. Frau Ingram is a union member. Fucker Carlson is a union member. But you won't catch him saying that out loud.
That's right. And listen, you might think that my industry is one that's a haven for a phony, baloney Hollywood liberals. And you know, there are a great many liberals in my industry, and some of them probably are phony baloney and from Hollywood. But the fact is, they're, you know, in my end of it, especially the behind the scenes type people, there's unfortunately a lot of MAGAs among me, especially in certain fields, you know, where there's a strong sort of macho, you know, identity to it all. And you know, it's everywhere. It's not just people talk like this. It's people that live in New York. It's people everywhere.
Yeah, get the fuck out of here.
Tell them, you know, that like the National Labor Relations Board for the past 4 years has been fighting to get, you know, the National Right for Work law enacted. Well, that won't affect us. What do you think this is going to do? You think you're special because you're making movies? You're not special. You're making a product the same way that a factory worker makes shoes. Somebody else puts soup in a can and seals it up. We're all making a product, and all of us can be replaced by scabs and non-union labor if you let them. So I've had this argument, and it's the same thing. Oh, then they do the pivot. Oh, so you want socialism? You want this? No, I didn't say that. No, but you know, the pivot's always the easiest way to go, right?
Well, that's run away. That rabbit's dynamite. When things get a little too unwinnable.
Yeah, and then we'll come up the Democrats and, you know, the liberals, and then and worst case scenario, and I have gotten this online. Oh, you think you're so smart? You know, yeah, you think you know everything. Oh, but I do know a few things, and I do believe it. Or you're trying to take away my First Amendment right? No, you have the full First Amendment right to make an ass of yourself, which you're doing very well, and very prodigiously right now, and I have the First Amendment right to criticize you for it. Which, you know what? This is a good segue. I didn't even realize it's a good segue. We should talk about something, Robin.
Yes?
We should talk about the Dave Chappelle.
Yeah, but you know, back when you uttered the single word Netflix, I thought, yeah, we're going to get to that too, aren't we?
We will. Have you watched it yet?
I have not. It's on the list for tonight. I think I'm gonna probably either before or after. I have to send out props to our pal Dave Number 11, who turned me on to an Amazon Prime series called Loudermilk.
Uh-huh,
which is really, really good. It's Peter. It's from the zany brain of Peter Farrelly. Great cast, good story, a little dark, funny as hell. To the extent that addiction can be made funny, they figured out a way to do it. We just finished watching season one. So, yeah, I'll do that, and then, because I got to take one for the team, I will watch, to my detriment, I suspect, the new Dave Chappelle.
I'll give a little, little upfront confession. Before I came on today, Robin and I were doing a little bit of Facebook IMing back and forth, and she did mention to me that this might be a topic of discussion. So I did, in fact, watch the Dave Chappelle special called Closer on Netflix this afternoon because I wanted to do my homework and be ready for this. So I'm pulling up right now. Here it is. So I'll give you a little – you've probably been reading some of the articles today about it. Have you, I should ask?
Well, I have, and in particular, over on my Twitter timeline, I retweeted in its entirety a thread by a Twitter user named Terrified. Ha, see? And she is a trans woman who works at Netflix.
Mm.
And she said, yesterday we launched another Chappelle special where he attacks the trans community and the very validity of transness, all while trying to pit us against other marginalized groups. You're going to hear a lot of talk about offense. We are not offended. And I really liked her take on it because she went on to say, and I've actually said this on this program too, and there's stories that go with it. You know, that was fake, babes. Being trans is actually pretty funny. If you're someone who actually knows about the subject matter, how could volunteering for a second puberty not be funny? That isn't what he's doing, though. Our existence is funny to him, and when we object to his harm, we're offended. And goes on at great length and points out, you know, this is really, really a good thread. She is on Twitter. She is at Reign of Terra, T-E-R-R-A. I have retweeted it on if anybody wants to go and find it. And she talks about how basically he is regurgitating TERF, and they're horrible people, TERF ideology. But she calls out her own privilege because she says, what we object to is the harm that content like this does to the trans community, especially trans people of color, and very specifically, black trans women. People who look like me, because she's white, people who look like me aren't being killed. I'm a white woman. I get to worry about Starbucks writing T-A-R-A instead of T-E-R-R-A on my drink. And goes from there, and it is a masterclass. And I highly recommend the thread to anyone who follows me on Twitter. Read it and internalize it and understand exactly. And so that's why I said, you know, I'll probably watch it and then cleanse my palate with something that actually makes me laugh. Because this is not going to make me laugh, I don't think.
No, well, listen, first of all, Dave Chappelle is a very, very funny person. And that should be obvious to most people. I mean, he's been doing it for a long time.
And he gets away with it under the guise of, well, I make fun of everybody.
Well, Don Rickles used to say that, but not really. I mean, I'm just going to talk about this what I just saw a couple of hours ago. And, you know, I guess I'll give you a spoiler alert, but most of the special is about this subject. You know, he really doesn't go into a whole lot more other than I don't know why all the trans people are getting offended just because I don't consider them, you know, real.
Well, there's that.
Well, here's the quote, by the way, first of all. And this is, you know, I understand context. I understand pulling quotes and how, et cetera, et cetera. But here's a quote, one of the quotes, just for to help us all out.
Okay.
They canceled J.K. Rowling. My God, he said. Effectually, she said gender was a fact. The trans community got mad as shit. They started calling her a TERF. I'm Team TERF. Gender is a fact. And then he was also, he started out actually the whole special by defending DaBaby. You know who DaBaby is, right?
I'm slightly.
DaBaby's a rapper. Listen, if they've got a name like DaBaby or The Weeknd or, you know, the office chair, they're usually hip hop artists.
Sure.
If they got a vowel, you know, a stationary object for a name or a vowel or something, that's a clue in there. But I get, you know, DaBaby had made. Were you aware of this story? I mean, this is like a year ago or something, where on stage DaBaby made these jokes, supposed jokes about, you know, gay people having AIDS and all my real fans don't suck you know what out in the parking lot. And it caused a big hullabaloo, and DaBaby kind of walked back his statements after I'm supposing his management company told him to. And then later on, in public, he went back out again and said, I'm just kidding about that walk back. I meant everything I said. Fuck them. And so anyway, Dave Chappelle starts out the special by saying, DaBaby shot and killed somebody and nobody cared about that. But, you know, he says something anti-gay and you hurt their feelings and everybody's in an uproar about that. So right away there's false equivalency, as if, first of all, nobody cares about DaBaby killing somebody. I didn't even know about it because I don't know that much about DaBaby. You know, I can't whistle or hum a DaBaby tune to save my life. You know, I imagine if I were the family or friend of whoever DaBaby shot and killed, I'd care about that.
Yeah,
and I'm not a big fan of people who kill other people. I don't care if they've got really good beats. If you kill somebody, I'm kind of not thrilled with that. So, but in general, I mean, the whole thing wasn't really about DaBaby. Really, the whole special was really about Dave Chappelle and defending himself by not defending himself, like basically not choosing to dehumanize or not look at trans people as human in a way to defend that, you know, supposedly defend himself that he's got no problems with the trans community. Just the only problem he really has is that they all seem to be hysterical and offended at him. He's constantly making himself the victim of, you know, of people coming through.
Yeah, as we say, we say around here, pogo sticking himself up onto the cross.
Yeah, and listen, if you want to, you know, do an hour set about how you've been the victim of racism for your, I have no problem with that because that comes from a place of truth that I can understand, but I don't believe it's entirely true that. In every single case, the person who criticized Dave Chappelle for being transphobic in his previous special is a wild-eyed hysteric who will not listen to calm, reasonable Dave Chappelle. I have the feeling it's a little more nuanced than that. You know, it's kind of like when you listen to your friend tell a story about an argument they got in and how they're always the most calm and rational person who totally
won
that argument.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when you talk later to that person's friend, or whoever was there, it's like, he was kind of an asshole the whole time, and you know, he didn't say that. He must have thought of that later after the whole thing was done with. And you know, so yeah, there's three sides to every story. yours, mine, and the truth, and nobody's wrong. But so that's real. A lot of it is basically just I'm a victim here, and you know all of this cancel culture and political correctness is so mean that this is going to be my last special. I'm taking my ball and going home. That's a lot of it, and because he's got an audience.
Are you telling me that this is a 90-minute pout?
This is a 70-minute pout, basically.
Ugh.
You know, with a cheering audience to, you know, so that when he says stuff like, you know, a trans woman is not a woman. He says something else of like, you know, you don't really have a pussy. It's like Impossible Burger. It's not really a burger. You know, your pussy, you know, might as well smell like beet juice or something to that effect.
Oh, God.
And in another point, he talks about how he got into a fight with a lesbian and actually hit her because supposedly he didn't recognize her as a woman. He thought the lesbian was a man. So he said, I did beat the shit out of her. I'm not going to lie. It was her fault. I had no choice. So he kind of goes after feminists, too.
Wonder if there's a statute of limitations on that.
Well, I think the story went out to TMZ, and for all I know, Dave Chappelle, like, settled to make it go away. Whatever. It's just, and then here's the kicker, though. At the very end, and I know this is a spoiler, but I'm going to just tell you.
That's fine.
He brings up a story with a trans person named Daphne Dorman, who was a would-be stand-up comedian, who incidentally worshipped the ground that Dave Chappelle walked on, called him her mentor, her guide, her everything. So, of course, Dave takes a liking to her, and she becomes Dave Chappelle's version of a black best friend. Because even though she doesn't see anything wrong with Dave Chappelle's prior statements about the transgender community, she thinks it's hilarious. So therefore, she's representing the voice of all trans people, I suppose.
Right, right. There's always a Sonder Commando. There's always a capo.
Yeah.
You know, sure.
It's like my black best friend says, you know, I can use the N-word because I'm practically black. It's cool. It's cool with them, so it's cool, right? No, it is not cool. And then here's the kicker, too. At the end of Dave's story about Daphne Dorman, who was a real person, I checked just to be sure, because you never know these days.
I notice you're using the past tense.
Daphne Dorman committed suicide. And in the special,
shit,
Dave doesn't say, but he kind of says, not my fault, it's all the trans community for pressuring the shit out of her to disassociate with me, Dave Chappelle. You got to hear it to believe.
Oh, that's so edgy.
So, in retrospect, then trans people are overly sensitive. They're hysterical. They're constantly hysterical. Their eyes are always bugging out. They're always screaming and yelling, while Dave calmly tries to reason with them.
You know, I haven't done any screaming and yelling yet.
Somebody's suicide.
I haven't done any screaming and yelling yet. Don't plan on it.
But, you know, I mean, listen, Dave's... I probably laughed maybe three punchlines that I laughed at. There were actually a few things I agreed with. I mean, Dave talked about how the black women are often not included in the white woman, feminist worldview. And I think that's proven to be true.
Yeah.
I'm no expert on this, but I've got eyes and ears. And I could see that
that's where if I understand correctly, that's where intersectional feminism comes from.
Yeah. You know, from what I understand.
The lack of inclusivity.
Yeah,
and it is something that people are trying to remedy.
Yeah, they are. But for the longest time, feminism as an image was defined by something that was white, that was urban, and was middle class. And, you know, all the you know, anyway, so I agreed with him on that. For what that's worth, and you can watch it and maybe agree or disagree with things, and maybe there's more nuance to the LGBTQ comments than I'm getting at.
I want to stop there if we can just sort of drill down on that for a moment, because that is a valid point. And you know how much time I've spent in the so-called environmental movement. I call it a human rights movement because environmentalism is all too often exactly what you were talking about in the other sense. It's very white. it was very white. It was a movement that was not inclusive, but often is not exclusive. And only in the last couple of decades, and maybe not even that, has it become less so as we begin to understand the concept of environmental justice. Because it turns out, you know, that they never build the great big toxic polluting plant next to a McMansion community of $500,000 homes.
Not in my backyard.
Right. I remember 15 years ago, maybe, hearing somebody from Colorado say, you know, we would never tolerate blowing up the mountains over up above Vail and Telluride. Well, of course not. Wealthy people live there. Wealthy white people live there.
That's right.
And so that's very real. And it's like the young woman who posted the Twitter thread that I mentioned there. You know, she acknowledges it. What the people, you know, I can be pissed off, and maybe, I don't know, maybe he'll give, you know, he's like a virus in this sense that he had a room full of people who went out and will now spread his talking points and do the TERF's work for them. And TERFing began in England with white middle class women and upper class women, okay, who were privileged in the extreme. And it metastasized. It spread to the United States, and it does cause great harm. But Dave Chappelle is doing more harm to black trans women than any other single subset of transness. Plain and simple.
Yeah, and you did allude earlier, and I don't know how to express it properly. You did allude earlier. There is a big thing where he's constantly minimizing the experience of trans people, and for that matter, feminists, by comparing it to the experience of blackness, and as if there is no intersectionality. He does mention in passing a few times, it does seem to acknowledge that black people can be trans, but he really basically every one of these horrible ogres who are so mean to Dave Chappelle is some form of a white person stereotype thing with pinched faces and bug eyes who come out of Walmarts and follow him to his car and stuff.
Well, one of the things that goes hand in hand with this sort of unstated is that and I've commented on this on a number of occasions, probably to the point that this community is sick of it, but the larger issue of transness is always about trans women. It's almost never about trans guys. And that's not a critique of trans guys. I consider them my siblings every bit as much as a trans woman, because the bigotry is still there. But the fact of the matter is, he's not worried about them, because as edgy as he may try to come across, he is and I know it's a Latinate word, and it's like eyes roll back in heads. For as much as he seems like he's outside the mainstream, he's as mainstream as can be, and he is in fact an agent of the patriarchy.
That ding 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 ding, absolutely, and he benefits from it constantly.
Yeah. And something else that our buddy Mark just pointed out to me, you know, it's, let me get the Twitter open again. Not just TERF, also anti-Semitism. This should surprise no one, since Chappelle is, to give him the benefit of the doubt, at least Nation of Islam adjacent.
Yeah, no, he throws a few jabs at the Jews in his special.
And it's nausea inducing.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you drill down into the UK TERFism, you don't have to knock on the walls too hard before you hear that hollow thump and you stick the crowbar in and look, they're Nazis.
Mm.
There are significant significant voices inside the turf movement in England who are unrepentant white supremacists, unrepentant neo-Nazis, and they're all, and it should come as no surprise, because to use a term that another dear friend of the program taught me about, they are in the end eliminationists, one and all. They seek the elimination of the people that they deem to be sufficiently other to not deserve to live. And so the other thing that I wanted to mention is that there's something that goes hand in hand here when I was talking about they never talk about the trans guys. They aim the same, they use the same weapons and aim the same barbs at trans women that they do at cis women. And it has to do, I guess, with estrogen. And that is, and to hear you describe it, he's doing it, hysterical, bug-eyed, screaming, unable to... unable to control emotional responses and deal with things in a sort of cool, Apollonian, discursive fashion. But I don't think it's too Apollonian to beat the shit out of somebody for only using words. So, yeah. And by the way, Jack in Shreveport says, I think Chappelle worked on a drug problem during his time off between his old show and now. If so, I wonder if there was a religious component to that. And if so, did that religious component influence him into anti-LGBTQ, anti-etc. frame of mind?
Well, I was thinking of something when you were talking to Robin about the fixation on trans women as opposed to trans men. I think it goes back to the toxic masculinity thing.
Sure.
I think that perhaps trans men see trans men who have become women, or men who were born women but later biologically became women. Maybe they see it as a betrayal, or maybe it's just because they feel like, well, I can't fuck that anymore. I don't know what it is. It's some sort of ownership patriarchal thing.
It's a real, real stinky onion is what it is. And Brother Deacon Asa just offered up a different take, and I think there's validity to it. Asa says, I didn't want to chime in, but I took one for the team and watched the Netflix special a couple of nights ago. I have a slightly different take. I think Chappelle might have a thing for trans women, and he doesn't know how to address it. Anyone remember Eddie Murphy with the two trans women in the back of the limo?
Yeah.
Anybody? Anybody?
I do.
Because the fact, I think it is real, because even me, I've made jokes about it. I've even read some of their emails on air. I have chasers, and chasers is a term within the trans community for guys who fetishize trans bodies and get off on the idea of having sex with trans women. Okay, it's yucky. It's really objectifying. It's gross.
I pulled up the quote that he said on the literal quote that Chappelle says on the show, and this makes it this also just sort of brings it home to Chappelle. I'm not quoting him yet, but this is my opinion. To Chappelle, it's really about that thing of pussy, and it's like that. Pussy that he either gets to have or gets to be in proximity of, that's how he defines gender. Because here's what he says. Gender is a fact. Every human being in this room, every human being on Earth had to pass through the legs of a woman to be on Earth. I'm going to stop there for a second. I guess he hasn't really heard of C-sections. That is a fact. Now, I am not saying that trans women aren't women. I am just saying that those pussies they got, you know what I mean? I'm not saying it's not pussy, but it's beyond pussy or impossible pussy. It tastes like pussy, but that's not quite what it is it? That's not blood. That's beet juice. Jokes, folks!
Jesus. Thank you for lightening that moment a minute. Yeah, that stupid fucker.
What it's all about is, do you have a pussy, and can I, Dave Chappelle, get into proximity of that pussy?
Right.
If I can't or don't care to, then it's not a pussy.
Oh, but it's not just that. It's I sure would like to, but then I'd have to think maybe I might be. and that's another off ramp to madness, is the idea that, it's part and parcel of trans women or women, you know, the hashtag, but because of his hang-ups, if he were, and I think Brother Deacon Ace has got a point, he'd kind of like to, because some trans women are fucking beautiful, and they work really hard to be that way, just like any cis woman does.
Sure.
And he would like to get some of that. But then he'd have to feel all ooky and wonder if he was all gay and stuff. It reminds me of something that Pink Shrek, you know, Joe Rogaine, said.
Shrek.
Yeah, Pink Shrek. He said that he used to really, really respect Richard Pryor until he found out that Richard Pryor had had sex with men.
Mm. Supposedly Marlon Brando, by the way. Did you know that? Quincy Jones said Marlon Brando and Richard Pryor had sex.
I would not be surprised at all. According to legend, Quincy Jones had sex with just about anything that wasn't moving.
Well, look, you know, I mean, such things have been said about our former vice president.
Oddly enough, yes.
Yeah.
By the way, we got a nice note from Matt in San Francisco. It's Fleet Week in San Francisco. Subject line. Thanks, gentlemen. It's Fleet Week in San Francisco, and the Blue Angels are practicing in the skies above the city today. It's quite jarring as the jets scream by. Your conversation has been a great distraction from all the noise. And I'm happy to be that distraction. And I know Dan is, too. So thank you, Matt. Jude
says, I wonder how many of those sailors are going to come down to the Tenderloin district.
Gosh, don't you just wonder? Yeah. Okay.
Not
there's
anything wrong with that.
No. Jude says, thank you both. Enjoying the two of you having this time to let it flow, even in the midst of a serious subject matter. The key is you're both provided the time to engage to the end of each thought. Thank you, Jude. And I'm going to throw, I was thinking about this earlier today, because trans women have been around for, well, about as long as there's been human beings. I've got this old, basically rule of thumb. Cultures don't make rules against things until the thing becomes a problem or a perceived problem. So, for instance, if you go back in time to, say, the Bible and all the rules associated with the besides the Ten Commandments, you know, there's a rule against fucking the sheep and the goats.
Mm-hmm.
Well, God doesn't have to promulgate a law against fucking goats and sheep unless the people that he's giving the rules to are already having a goat and sheep fucking problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, somewhere in Deuteronomicus, he says, oh, and by the way, a woman shall not put on the raiment of a man, and a man shall not put on the raiment of a woman. The problem being, I've never been able to figure that one out, because they were all wearing dresses. So I guess I guess at that point in time, it was, you know, whether or not one wore a particular kind of necklace, or I don't know, but you put lamb's blood on their lips to make them red and rosy, or I got nothing. But again, you don't get rules until there's a problem that the rule has to address. You don't just make those out of whole cloth. And that having been said, we've been around for a terribly long time, Dan, and I don't know that my father suspected anything about me. I deliberately waited until both he and my mother were gone so that they would not have to be embarrassed or humiliated by me. And so as a consequence, you know, there were a lot of years. But when I was a kid, my dad, who had served in the Second World War in the United States Navy with home ports in places like Bremerton, Washington, and Pearl Harbor, and stops along the way all over the South Pacific, something would come on TV and there would be a reference to a cross-dresser or something. And, you know, like, you remember Sally Jesse Raphael? Problems. Everybody's got them. Let's talk about them. I'm Sally Jesse Raphael. Remember her? Or, well, you know, Phil Donahue.
She was kind of cute in a way with the pink glasses.
Right, yeah. And she'd have all kinds of people from marginalized groups on. I knew somebody who was on Sally Jesse Raphael one time.
Bragger.
Well, sorry. It was a segment called A Day in the Life of a Stripper. But anyway, she'd had, and my dad would see some, you know, drag queen or cross-dresser, transvestite, whatever. And I remember him saying it more than a couple of times. You know, you can always tell them by their hands. You can always tell them by their hands. They got big hands. Mm. And I just kind of let it blow by. But it went and it lived on one of my little trans brain cells somewhere along the way, Dan. And it took a long time, but I realized, you know, he didn't spend all of his time down in the belly of that aircraft carrier. And late in life, I said, so, Dad, when you got Liberty and, like, Pearl, I said, did you go out and did you ever pay for it? He said, hell yeah, I had to pay for it every time. And I put two and two together and added 12 and carried 5, and I kind of wondered if maybe once upon a time Dad had gotten down to the business end of things and went, holy shit, what's that? Huh. Because, the woman said on Twitter, it is kind of funny. It can be hilarious if you know what you're laughing at and what you're laughing about and whether you're laughing with or laughing at.
That's right.
But, you know...
See, there's this
kind of like you go, Dad, really? Wish I could ask you that question now. Maybe I shouldn't have waited so damn long.
You know, I mean, there's this whole thing, too, now about... But, and this has been going on, this gripe has been going on for the 90s, since the 90s in my memory, perhaps even earlier, of, well, you know, it's so politically correct now, they're killing comedy, and comedy isn't funny anymore because everything's cancel culture. And it's like, whoa, there's still plenty of comedy out there for everybody of all types, and you can still say all kinds, you can be Dave Chappelle, you can get a platform on Netflix. You know, you're just going to have people being mad at you if you want to do that. You know, you can still be Joe Rogan and get fabulously wealthy. It's funny how the people who are getting fabulously wealthy, being not canceled, are the ones that complain the loudest about it.
And, you know? Two of them that come to mind, and it's really gratifying to see, there are some, and there always have been. I mean, you go back to people like Phyllis Diller or Joan Rivers. Yeah. And even before that, you know, the great comic actresses. But there are modern women who are modern comics who are absolutely gut-busting. We went back, Agnes and I did, and rewatched one of Eliza Schlesinger's specials.
She's good, yeah.
Oh, God, she's good. And then another friend turned me on to, and it's odd, Eliza Schlesinger was, when she was starting out, she was a protege of Bobcat Goldthwait.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think he directed her first couple of big specials. And, of course, Bobcat Goldthwait was best friends with Robin Williams.
Uh-huh.
So there's kind of a pedigree here. And if you're listening for it, you can hear it.
Mm.
It's really neat. And then, like I said, a friend of mine turned me on to another woman who is also gut-bustingly funny. And her name is Kathleen Madigan.
I've heard of her.
And she's got a 2016 special called Bothering Jesus.
Mm.
And we watched that one and had to reach for the Kleenex because we just, you're laughing so hard. And, oh, I hope I didn't pee. You know, one of those kind of things. And she is a protege, and you can hear it in her delivery style. She is a protege of Lewis Black.
Mm.
And so, you know, these are people who are taking, these are, you know, high-powered comedians who are taking women who might not otherwise get the break that they need under their wing and helping to advance their careers. And it works. I mean, they're great. And this seems like the exact opposite. You know, what it boils down to, and I know you know this concept very, very well, Dan. Dave Chappelle likes to kick down as opposed to punch up. And that's all this is.
Refine why it isn't, but you'll have to.
Okay. But it's, you know.
Yeah, he basically doesn't believe in. But his basic thing is, we're comedians. We should be able to punch however we want, and you can. Again, you can punch up, down, sideways at yourself in the mirror. You can do all of that. Just don't expect everybody to love you. That's it.
And don't do a 70-minute stand-up pouting about it.
Yeah.
And so what amazes me is that we are a tiny, tiny, tiny minority of the overall population, not just of this country, but of this planet. And yet we are, as Shakespeare would say, a name for being put upon. I think that was Shylock who uttered that line, wasn't it?
Not the best role model in terms of representation, but yes.
No, but he gets to say some really profound things.
It's true.
You know, Hamlet's not exactly a great role model either, but he says things like, I could be bounded in a nutshell and count myself a king of infinite space were it not that I had bad dreams. I think we can all identify with
that. Hamlet was kind of a privileged white dude.
Oh, very.
You know, whereas at least Shylock, you know, Shylock had the anti-Semitism going against him.
Yeah,
so
and Shylock was working for a living. You may not have liked what he did, but he was working for a living. You can't say that about Hamlet.
The best representation of his work.
No. And Shakespeare's full of it. I don't mean full of it, but there's a lot of... He's a product of his times.
Shakespeare was of his time.
What I'm trying to get at is, why are we so scary? You know, the world had a hissy over, what was it, Renee Richards.
Mm-hmm.
She had to fight like a woman possessed to be allowed to play professional women's tennis, and promptly got her ass handed to her.
Mm-hmm.
The arguments were made then that they're made now. If you let somebody who used to be a guy participate in women's sports, you know, they're just going to ruin women's sports. I haven't seen that Renee Richards ruined women's professional tennis in the least.
Yeah, and you know what? I like sports a lot. I watch sports. I occasionally at least pretend to sort of play them, throw a ball through a hoop or something. But as much as I like sports, I don't feel like, well, how does acknowledging the existence of trans people affect how we play a game? I don't consider that the more important question than how do we treat trans people better? How do we acknowledge
right.
that they're human beings that get to have stuff? You know, I think that's more important than, well, gee, this person might now hit a ball faster than somebody else. You know, I mean, and as you pointed out, it's at least so far, at least at one time, was not scientifically, well representative in the case of Renee Richards that, oh, yeah, automatically testosterone means you're going to win at tennis games. Or lack of, or whatever.
And there's oodles of science out there to counter all of this this turf hatefulness.
Oh, yeah.
But I also wanted to mention I also wanted to mention something else, and I guess I'll have to put this up on the dreaded Facebook. But I did post it on Twitter as an adjunct to Reign of Terror's lengthy post about Dave Chappelle. And what I said is I don't like pointing out problems without offering up something that at least resembles a solution. And this video is an actual scientific antidote to the filthy turf hatred being hustled for a fast, dirty buck by Netflix and Dave Chappelle. And it's from a guy named, he calls himself Renegade Science Teacher. And he is an evolutionary biologist. His name is Forrest. And he made a video called Sex and Sensibility. It's on YouTube. You can just look it up under Sex and Sensibility. The opening screen is a guy sitting behind a table. He's got his chin resting in the palm of his hand. And in the colors, in the multicolors, it says, "Let's talk." So you'll know you're in the right place when you go to find it. And what he does is offer up this amazing deconstruction of virtually every pathetic, sophomoric, not very well thought out argument that, as you've described it, Dave Chappelle puts forward.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, Dave Chappelle doesn't have a leg to stand on, and I don't know, I guess maybe he could call the Renegade Science Teacher a motherfucker or something, and the crowd would go, "Ho, ho, ho, I called him a motherfucker. I'll tell you what, he showed him up." But the fact of the matter is, what this guy puts forward utterly destroys everything that Dave Chappelle is talking about.
I hope so.
You might even want to look at it. It's kind of a lengthy video. I think it's about 30 minutes long, but it is really, really worth it, and it's really engaging, really watchable. It's really accessible because the guy specializes in making science videos for kids, adolescents. And he puts things in ways that you and me and Joe and Jane Sixpack can get. And I would love to see that thing go viral as a response to the topic we're addressing.
Well, look, here's the thing, too, is that, you know, Chappelle in the special, and one other thing he does is he does a lot of comparing the suffering of the trans community to the suffering of the black community. And one of his basic principles of the jokes are, well, you know, an LGBTQ person will lament to him, we've been suffering for decades and fighting for decades. It's like, you know who you're talking to here? You know, my people have been suffering for, like, centuries. And, okay.
Competitive suffering. Yes.
But it's not a competition. It's not who suffers the most gets all the prizes. You're all suffering. You know, black people get shit on to this day. Trans people get shit on. Women get shit on. It's not like compassion is a limited prize for whoever. You know, you all get compassion if we all want to. You know, it's not a zero sum game. Compassion.
The quality of mercy is not strained.
Distribute it and exercise it and fight for it.
Yeah.
And it takes away nothing from you as a black person to acknowledge that others who are not you have suffered as well. You know, you don't hear me whining a whole lot about my people because my people haven't suffered that much. I'm trying to do my little parts here and there to, if that can be remedied in my lifetime, I'd like to have some little tiny teeny tidbit iota of something to have be at least in that conversation. So I put my foot on the right side of the line at the very least.
Yeah, well, you know? but see, it's a very right wing, privileged, patriarchal kind of thing to see the entire world as a zero-sum game, as if,
right.
if someone achieves a greater quantum of rights, that it comes at the expense of someone else's rights, and that is pure, unmitigated bullshit, and it is particularly intellectually lazy.
Right.
So, well, yeah. it's.
Look, my industry, and I'm going to go a little off topic here. My industry has been a very racist industry in a lot of ways in terms of providing opportunity for those who do not look like me. Things are getting better, but they're still pretty fucking bad. And all you have to do is stream any number of shows to see, like, oh, you know, what are the casts like, you know, and yeah, maybe now in the past 5 years, every show now has to have at least one black best friend or one, you know, one this and that, you know, token, what have you. But besides the on-screen representation, really the racism and the sexism and the anti-everything else-ism really is the behind-the-scenes stuff. More often than not, guys who look like me will get a chance to be a creative force, to be a producer, a director, a writer. We're just given those opportunities much, much more. And the idea that women can't be funny is still around. You're still fighting women can't be funny. And you're still fighting this idea that, oh, if we're doing a show about hip hop, then we can hire a black writer. It's like, no, put them on the Mary Tyler Moore Show or whatever. You know, they're writers. If they're good writers, they can co-opt any, you know, they can co-opt an experience and make it truthful and real. I mean, it's part of the reason that I believe also that a white writer can write about something or can direct a movie about something other than white people. You just have to be very careful. You have to know, you have to come in with information and you have to come in with experience. And it doesn't hurt if you have a collaborator who has lived the experience or whatever. But my industry is still pretty bad, is what I'm saying. We're not the haven for liberalism that you know we're all pumped up to be.
Well, and you touch on something there, Dan. That's going to, if there were any weird little right wing lurkers on the program, it would send them into paroxysms of barking, hooting, howling rage. And that is that, you know, when you say, you know, my industry hasn't been pretty good, and we can point to every other industry, there's been horrible racism throughout organized labor, even though, like, the United Mine Workers were originally founded as an integrated union. The coal operators attacked that, I think, in 1948, and there was a great racist purge throughout the UMWA. But what you're talking about is structural racism, and yep. Oops, son of a gun, look at critical race theory. And what it boils down to is they don't hate critical race theory because it's wrong, these maggot assholes. They hate it because they know it's true, and they don't want to hear about it because they like it because it works to their damn benefit. Sorry.
Ding, ding. Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, though, is that, you know, the product that we, and again, I'll refer to what I do besides movies, TV, it's product. I help create a product. And our product, very often, is the one that says, hey, you know, everybody should get a chance. Everybody should have their voice heard. Everybody should be represented. And everybody has the potential to be good, potential to be evil. But at the same time, we say these things. We cheerlead for them. But yet, then it's like, well, you know, what's the writer's room like? Is it all dudes? You know, is there that one token black person that sits in a corner and they don't never get their jokes into the script? But they're there because the network made them or something. You know, there's still a lot of bad shit going on in my industry. And I'm just saying my industry is an example.
Right. You know? Sure.
And we're part of the big structure altogether. And, you know, my union's gotten better. It used to be really bad. When I first got in, it was in 1994, you know, it was mostly dudes, white dudes. There were some women, very often the daughters of union members.
Yeah, they passed the DNA test.
Yeah, and then also the women tended to be put into, oh, you're a woman, so your hair and makeup, your costumes. Maybe you're a set decorator. But, you know, prop masters, set dressers, those were stuff that it took time to evolve to where now...
Electrics, grips.
Yeah. Electrics and grips, yeah. It was a huge deal, seeing like the first...
And those are two crafts that are very, very macho, are they not?
They are, and I don't want to go too far into that kind of criticism because they are my union kin.
Right, sure. I get that.
Yeah, there's a lot of misogyny in certain crafts and fields, especially where people get to handle tools. That way, if you put a tool in somebody's hand, it's like a second dick. And
Jesus, wait a minute. Okay. Just,
so
you don't get to do that and not be acknowledged. I'm sorry. Okay.
Well, I am going to leave pretty. I know you started late. You want to go late, but I'm losing my voice.
I
did want to say one other thing too, because I got on one tangent. Let me just finish up a tangent and see if I can do that before I tangentialize into something else. Which is that, you know, among the online arguments today I've had about Chappelle, and yeah, I've had some online arguments with people who accuse me of wanting to kill comedy, which I don't. I love comedy. But somebody said something to the effect of, well, you know, Don Rickles said all this stuff and he was a genius and Phyllis Diller and, you know, and Blazing, you know, and Lenny Bruce, you know, they always bring up Lenny Bruce. And listen, you know, those guys were great. Those were geniuses. I'm not a huge Don Rickles fan, but I understand why, you know, I understand how fast and how clever he was, even if I wasn't always nuts about his comedy. But, and I don't, you know, want to cancel Don Rickles. But the fact is that all these people that this one online person I was, for some reason, dealing with, kept bringing up all these people from, like, the mid-1970s. And I'm like, you know what? That was 50 years ago. You know, comedy evolves. And audiences evolve. Audiences in 1971 might have been a different, literal different audience. It might have been all white people in the audience at a Dean Martin roast or a Don Rickles show, but now maybe it's not. Maybe it's a more integrated show, and maybe some of those people in the audience, they're not so nuts about some of the stuff in 2021, or maybe they feel more empowered to say, you know, that's a misogynist, or that's, you know, I don't want to see a limp wrist gay queer joke. You know, I want yeah, I can take a joke, but if I'm always the butt of the joke, I get kind of tired of that. Comedy has to evolve, you know, and so it's not the audience's fault for saying, no, we don't think that's funny. Yeah, we might have in 1971, audiences might have thought that bit was funny, but that we don't, you know, that's not our fault. Make new jokes. You're a professional comedian. Write new jokes, write new material, take the temperature of the room and create material that will make us laugh, because we pay money to see you laugh. We want to laugh. We just don't want to laugh at some of this crap you're saying, you know. And if you go that 50-year thing, you know, 1971 to 2021, well, look at, you know, in 1971, I was a kid, and I did watch sometimes the Johnny Carson show if my folks let me stay up late. Or I did watch some of those Dean Martin roasts, and I'd see Don Rickles, and he'd make jokes at Sammy Davis Jr.'s expense and just sit there and kind of take it, you know, because that's what he was expected to do. But, you know, if you go back from that 50 years from that, let's say to the mid-20s, if I were a kid in the 1970s and I saw, let's say, two white guys in blackface, Amos and Andy, I think even I would have been horrified. Seven-year-old me would have known that was fucked up, you know?
Yeah.
And most of the 1971 audience would have said, this is fucked up.
Well, I mean, you're a film buff extraordinaire. The first time you saw Al Jolson's The Jazz Singer, how'd you feel about it?
Well, it's, you know, the content, it's a terrible movie. It's actually not a good movie at all. I mean, it's momentous because it was the first, and not even really, it was the first American movie to employ sound. The French were doing little, using sound, but it was the first full-length feature film with sound. But not only the blackface bit, but I mean, the whole, you know, it's very, you know, heavy on the Jewish stereotype stuff itself. And it was made, listen, Al Jolson was Jewish, and for all I know, the director and writer was, but they were doing what they thought was they were expected to do. And it was a big hit at the time, etc. Not a good movie. Let's just say that. And I watch a lot of old movies. Like, I watch silent movies. I just watched I watched Sherlock Jr. with Buster Keaton just the other day. So I get old movies, and I get different types of humor and stuff. But, anyway, no, not a big fan of that.
And you know, some of the old comedy is universal, and oddly enough, it winds up being universally funny because of not just because of what it is, but because of what it isn't.
And look, you know, I still think Blazing Saddles is funny. Now, to me, it's not funny because white people get to say the N-word in the movie and get away with it. I think it's funny because those white people who say the N-word in that movie are idiots. They're meant to be idiots. They're shown to be idiots. And the person who is not an idiot is the black guy.
Yeah.
So I'm okay with that.
Again, thank you, Richard Pryor.
For me, cisgender, white, male, patriarchal representative, I'm okay with it. And if you're not, I understand.
Yeah. Okay. So I know you're losing your voice, and I know we got to go. But I have a request here. Brother Deacon Asa says, ask Dan about Dave Chappelle's blackface comment. I don't want to be the one ruining it all for you.
I don't know that one, or I would. I know that any entertainer who's, I don't know the Dave. I can Google it right now.
From what I was reading from Brother Deacon Asa, I thought it was part of this latest whatever it is he did.
I mean, Brother Deacon has watched a lot of movies and stuff too. I can't get it. Google. Dave Chappelle says TERFs look at trans women the way blacks might look at blackface. I'm trying to process that false equivocation.
Yeah, which is exactly what it is. I think that may be all there is to it. It is not the same thing.
Yeah, it's apples and shoes.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, one last question, I promise. Scary Jerry wants to know, do you have any thoughts about the upcoming Dune and Foundation? Well, Foundation is already out. Those science fiction.
I'm not a huge sci-fi guy, Scary Jerry. I'm more of a monster. Like I am starting to watch stream scary stuff, getting ready for Halloween. I watched this Japanese one called House the other day that was really stupid and weird, but kind of fun. But about Dune, I would watch it. just because, I mean, the thing is, Scary Jerry, is I can't go to theaters yet. That's another thing the morons and idiots have done to me, is because of my particular situation, I haven't been to a movie theater since probably, you know, January 2020, if that. So I can't see Dune in a theater, which I'm sure would make a difference. But here's the funny thing. I saw the original David Lynch Dune back in 1986 or 5. I saw that in a theater. And I took a girl that I really didn't want to. I didn't like that much, but she kind of was into me. So it was kind of a bad date all around. And I didn't purposely take her to a bad movie just to like do something mean to her. I'm not close. But yeah, we did kind of stagger out together. Like, well,
that was a thing.
Sting was okay.
Oh, but I'll tell you what, it stays with me to this day, Dan. Sting was early in his acting career, let's say.
Yeah.
And you've been through acting classes, and I've been through acting classes, and we know what it means to take a reading on a line. And in that climactic knife fight scene, he has to say, "I will kill you," on a couple of different occasions. And I just love trying to imagine David Lynch trying to get a different reading out of Sting, because he gives, that's four words, right? "I will kill you," four words. And he gets the most awkward reading of that line out of Sting, and I giggle every time I watch it, because I do. I love that movie for not necessarily the right reasons. But he's pointing that knife at... You know, at Paul, and he finally says, "I will kill you."
I wonder if that's
and I can
on,
just see David Lynch saying, "You know, okay, it's not going to get any better."
Yeah. Well, now David Lynch is like, "I like weird. I'll take it." You know?
Print it. Yeah,
perfect.
So if you do watch it again, wait for that line. That and little Ollie saying, "How can this be? For he is the Kwisatz Haderach." And it was so obviously dubbed, but no.
But as for the new one, I'll probably watch it, probably stream it. Never was it, you know, oddly enough, I grew up a monster kid, but it never translated into either sci-fi or like the D&D stuff. Like I was just monsters all the way, you know, especially.
No, I'm the exact opposite. I was sitting close, three years old and sitting too close to the television, because even my dad would watch Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
And so sci-fi early on, some fantasy, but mostly, I mean, I'm in the great universal debate, Star Wars or Star Trek. I'm definitely Star Trek.
Well, Star Wars isn't really science fiction. There's not a whole lot of science.
No, it's just a greatly expanded Seven Samurai.
Yeah, and Buck Rogers too. I love Seven Samurai.
Yeah, yeah,
it's kind of that. But no, I also, you know, for me, it's Night of the Living Dead just turned everything around in my life. That and Planet of the Apes, which is a sci-fi movie. I like Twilight Zone for what that's worth. Scary.
Oh yeah,
Skip Larry.
Yeah. I like Twilight Zone better than Night Gallery.
Oh, Night Gallery was just Twilight Zone in color with polyester pants. I mean, listen, I'm a big Roddy McDowell fan. I'd watch Roddy McDowell in anything, but even then, like when I watch Night Gallery and he'd come on, I'd be like, this is not good. I'm a kid, and I know this.
I'm a kid, and this sucks. Dan, thank you so much.
Hey, before I go, let me plug something.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God, we almost didn't.
It's an idea I have. And maybe you can discuss among yourselves in the community to figure out the best way to approach it. One of my dreams in life that's never really come true is to be a game show host. I grew up loving game shows, Joker's Wild, Hollywood Squares, Password, all of that stuff, $10,000 Pyramid. So I want to do a game show on this show. So I've come up with an idea, which I'm going to call, for the sake of legally covering my ass, Not Jeopardy.
Right. Okay.
and it's going to be a version very similar to much of the play of Jeopardy, but in a few ways different. And one of them will be, we won't do like a buzzer system. Everybody will take a turn, and if you don't get your answer, other people then down the line get to try.
And it doesn't have to be in the form of a question.
No, because it's not Jeopardy. Don't
right.
sue me.
Exactly.
But it's basically a trivia. Basically, what I'm doing is proposing a trivia game where I get to be the host. And I would like you, Robin Kincaid, to be one of the contestants.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like for there to be two other contestants. Now, you know, it's up to you how this would be accomplished in terms of choosing the lucky two. One thing that I do have in my mind is I'd like to monetize this particular episode somehow, because we're always wanting to raise funds for your wonderful show, and you're also going to be taking some time off, I understand, to deal with your body.
Yeah, a lot.
A lot.
Beet
so
juice and
all.
So
you need some money, and so I'd like to help you raise money. And so if there's a way that we can do this that can help, right, like maybe turn it into, you know, the particular game show itself, maybe throughout we just keep pitching away like it's the Jerry Lewis telethon. I don't know. I don't know if it would be fair to have like whoever bids the most, bids the highest, gets to be the contestants. I don't know. I will tell you, too, that I've already figured out a prize for it, and I'll tell you what the prize is. Even. I like to make on my own, I like to make Sgt. Pepper album covers.
Yes.
But with different themes. Like I did one for Halloween where instead of, you know, the four Beatles, it was like Frankenstein, Dracula, Wolfman, and I think the Bride of Frankenstein on the front, you know, and then the whole row is filled with monsters. Only I use a lot of the templates of the original Sgt. Pepper, but just enough so I don't get sued, because that's important to me. Anyway, when we do this game show, I would like to offer up a prize to whoever wins it, which is the winner of the first episode of Not Jeopardy! Will get their own personalized Sgt. Pepper album cover. Can be whatever you want. Can be your family and friends. The very first one I ever made, the very first Sgt. Pepper I ever made was for my mom. For her, I think, 70th birthday, something like that. And I got, like, all of her friends to send me photos of themselves, like Facebook and all of that. And we printed it out. We put it in a nice frame, like one of those album cover frames. And gave it to her for a gift, and it was just, she has it in her apartment to this day. She loves it. And you could have the same, too. I think that would be the prize. And then maybe what we'll do to monetize it is we could have, like, whoever bids the highest that evening, I could do a second one just for that person as well. Something like that. But I want to fulfill my dream of being a game show host.
And I want you to. So let me just toss
it. I want you to have money, more money than you have.
Thank you.
And to keep this show on the air.
Yeah, because I am going to be gone from the air for a period of time. It's not unreasonable to think 2 weeks, maybe longer, depending on how things play out.
Right. We'll have to figure out how to deal with that. But it's going to cost you money, and we want that. So.
Yes. So just before you go, let me put this out there. Obviously, this is going to be a volunteer thing, and
yeah.
we're going to need people. We're going to need people who enjoy trivia. We need two because I'm there too. And
yeah, I'd like you to be one of the contestants, and I won't play favorites.
No, I know you won't.
I play fair and square, baby.
I know it is an above board game. And it is in no wise rigged, and there has been no payola involved.
Yeah.
So I have people in mind, but I'm going to wait and see who wants to who might want to play.
Right.
And so shoot me a note. Everybody knows how to reach me, and let's see who wants to play.
This is a special bonus for all the people who've managed to hang out. You know, all this time and listening to your show tonight.
Well, Jack in Shreveport said that the game show idea sounds awesome. Do we want to try to incorporate video?
No, I want to make it as simple as possible, because simple means less on-air mistakes.
Yes.
That's why I don't want to do a buzzer, because I don't want it to be a thing of, well, I buzzed first. No, I didn't. Like, how can you tell? You know,
right.
Without the visuals. And I don't have a studio, it's just me. So that's why I'm going to make it just as simple as
it'll
be.
It'll be a little bit like that that early game show that we never actually finished. 20 questions with then Bob.
Well, that's right.
I still want to finish that game. I had a blast with that. So shoot me a note if you're interested in this, and we'll find a couple of other players. And if it works out, maybe do it again. Who knows?
Yeah, like I said, prize. Definitely, I will offer the prize of the Sergeant Pepper cover, personalized to however you want it to be, and just for the fun of playing it as well, of course, and for the fun of listening to it. And I'm pretty good at trivia, but we'll see if you're better than me. We'll see how easy or hard this will be. I don't want to give too much away more than that.
Okay, sounds good. Well, shoot me a note. I'll be in frequent contact with Dan, and we'll get this set up. And let's see. Like I said, I am 1 month and 2 days from my surgery. I'll be leaving here on November the 1st. So we need to do it between now and Halloween.
Well, I'm not working right now, so I've got time on my hands.
Wonderful. Well, let's make this happen, Dan. Thank you so much, and thank you so much to Jude. Jude just jumped in and says, I'm kicking in support of our community's well-being and openness to understanding each other. And that is just beautiful, Jude. Jude is an angel and a guardian, guiding spirit of kindness and decency and love in this community. And I thank you so much, Jude. And that also finishes off Rico and Berg's challenge, which is great because that means that we've knocked down $150 of fundraising this evening, which is really, really important. Dan Fisher, thank you so much. I'm sorry I screwed up and we almost didn't do that. I apologize so heartily.
There's nothing to be about you. Your debts are paid for the rest of your life. You have no debts. Your credit is good here. You're now.
Well, thank you. You're just an absolute sweetheart. You really, really are.
And go on.
God, oh, shucks. But I always enjoy these. I just do so much. And wow, did we cover some ground.
Yeah, my feet are tired.
I know.
All right, let's talk later.
All right,
love
see you, Dan. Bye now.
Bye.
The one and only Dan Fisher. This all started 3 years ago when I found out entirely by a stroke of luck that Dan was needing good thoughts, hopes, whatever, as he faced his heart transplant. And it has begun a series of conversations that are absolutely precious to me, especially, being able to reestablish an old friendship. And that's the lovely thing about old friendships. You often find that they somehow have remained evergreen, and that is certainly the case with Dan and me. And now Dan gets an entirely new group of friends via the Horn Family Community Congregation. It's really, really special. So thanks, everybody. Thanks for answering Rico into Berg's Fuck Joe Manchin and let's add in Kirsten Cinnabon challenge. I hope it's not so grievously sticky and muggy and awful into Berg as autumn proceeds, Rico. We appreciate you so much, as we do each and every one of you who keep this program on the air. Thank you to our Patreon and PayPal subscribers. Thank you to our a la carte contributors. Thank you to each and every one of you who share your precious finite time engaging in this long-running conversation in whatever manner you so choose. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Sparky and Steve in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, HeadOn.live, for all you do. Remember, brand new Fresh Malloy on the way at 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, 6 p.m. Pacific. The best place to listen to the first run of Malloy is HeadOn.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20 plus years at the forefront of the struggle for human rights and environmental justice in Appalachia, and now a union shop. This would be a great time, of course, to reach out to your member of the House of Representatives and ask them to co-sponsor H.R. 2073, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. the AKE Act. It means the world to Appalachia, and we really want to see it passed in this Congress. We've never had a better chance. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Please stay safe. Do everything you can to stay safe. Wash your hands, don't touch your face, use your hand sanitizer, carry it with you everywhere you go, pants, pocket, purse, backpack, European-style messenger bag, and whatever it takes. Maintain your social distance. Wear your mask. And wear the best mask you can get your hands on. And for God's sakes, if somebody comes towards you saying, "My brother's poisoning people by giving them that COVID vaccine," avoid that person like the plague. Because he is. Later.